Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the program. So much to get to, so many things to talk about. The week that was last week was a nightmare. I apologize to all of our listeners and all the folks who contacted me and said, hey, what's going on? I had some computer problems, had some tech stuff, needed to be worked through a couple of things. When you're a small program like ours without a large budget, little things tend to get in the way, and I think we've got most of the, I think we're okay from going forth. With our producer leaving, it's left me with a lot more hands-on stuff, and I'm working through it. So I apologize, but I appreciate your support, and I appreciate all of the outreach of, hey, what's going on? We really miss the program. That speaks volumes to me, and I appreciate it. Thank you so much. And a lot of people offering to pitch in and help. That is fantastic. Thank you very much. But tonight on the program, we're going to talk a little bit about climate change. Yes, there was supposed to be a foot of snow yesterday. I got about an eighth of an inch. What happened? Don't know. Erratic nature of our weather. Could that have something to do with climate change? Gee, let me think about that. I don't know. Maybe we'll find out. Also, there are workers in the streets in Pittsburgh. Yes, the UPMC workers have said, you know what? We want to be recognized as decent human beings. We want to make a decent living. We want better wages, hours, and conditions. We want to be able to have health care so that when we get sick, because you know what I find ironic? I find it extraordinarily ironic that the people who are taking care of sick people, they themselves don't have anyone to take care of them when they're sick. But I guess that's really, really the conservative way, isn't it? Clean up my mess, take care of me, but, well, the heck with you. So we're going to talk about that. A whole bunch of stuff on the agenda. You know, a week away, you got tons of stuff to go over. Your thoughts, your questions, your comments. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So over the weekend, I had the opportunity to take my daughter to the Keystone Progressive Summit. They have it every year of, you know, this idea of bringing people together to talk about important issues, to talk about how you message and how you do things and how we can bring people together to start solving some of our problems, thought was a pretty good thing for my 11-year-old to see. And also, since I was asked to be one of the presenters on one of the panels on communication and messaging, I thought it'd be a good time for her to see Dad, you know, do something other than just yell about it. Clean up your room! I'm sick of that. I probably was when I was her age as well. So it was good for, you know, to see Dad actually do something a little bit out of the ordinary for her to see. So that was good. But, you know, the thing that got me is, you know, you go to these things and you meet so many people that throughout the year listen to the program. They podcast. They tune in on the stations that we're on. Or, you know, they watch online because if you want to go home and you want to watch, you want to see me in the studio waving my arms and going ballistic, we have a YouTube feed at thericksmithshow.com. You can watch. I've gone and I've watched some of it. I do look kind of funny. Just a thought. But, you know, here's the thing. You go to these things and you meet people that, you know, you've never seen, but maybe you've talked to, maybe they've emailed, and you have this personal connection. It's one of the things I love about doing this program. Is that you get to meet so many people from diverse backgrounds with different ways of thinking, different thought patterns. And, you know, time and time again, I get these folks coming up saying, you know, Rick, I may not agree with you 100% on this, but, you know, I'm thinking about it. And I'm thinking a little bit differently about it, especially on those worker issues. Because my point is, and, you know, to the progressive community, the vast majority of the people there are not labor people. They're not union people. You know, they're people who work for a living, but they never really thought of themselves. And, you know, they're mostly professional type folks, but they're folks who, to be honest, are not the, you know, the kind of folks that you would expect who would be out there pounding the pavement looking for looking for a contract. And when they come up to me, they say, you know what, I'm thinking about economic issues a little differently. I'm thinking about unions a lot differently. And, you know, I'm thinking of one particular conversation. You know, the woman said, you know, I don't know anybody who's ever been a part of a union. Nobody in my family ever has been. I probably never will be as a lawyer. But I, when you lay it out for me, I see the importance of why it's vitally important for working people to have a collective voice. And one of the things that got retweeted a bunch of times that I had said during the panel that I did is I said, you know, it's interesting that the people who preach individualism are the ones who are doing the collective action. And the people who are preaching collective action are the ones who are doing the solo thing. They're the ones who are, hooray for me, and I got my little silo, and I care only about this one issue, the heck with everything else. My point to all of them is we need to be thinking in terms of, yeah, we have our own individual issues, but this country isn't just one issue. And for all of our issues to be important, for all of the folks to come together and to be able to think about other things, you have to be able to feed your family. And it comes down to economics first and foremost. It comes down to feeding your family first and foremost. Being able to say, hey, you know, my kids, they're going to be okay. Being able to say, you know, being able to keep the roof over our head, that's more important. Because interestingly enough, you know, and I went into a couple of the stories that I've talked about here on the program often. When we did the labor history tour and went into Blair, West Virginia, and came across the Friends of Coal people who were strapping the sidearms and you know, look, I don't know if it's part of their culture, their everyday thing, or if it was meant to intimidate, or if they really were going to shoot one of us. But when you started talking about things that you could connect on, look, these folks, all they believed is all they have is coal. And they see us or anyone who would say anything we need alternatives as attacking their way of life. And it's issue after issue that the right has done a masterful job of putting their folks on the defensive. You know, whether it's gay marriage, whether it's religion, whether it's coal, whether it's oil, whatever it is, they've played the victim, the underdog. They're taking something from us. And I told the story about, you know, the guy I knew who had a girlfriend and a child up in Massachusetts and a wife and two kids back in Pennsylvania, worried about, you know, two guys getting married, somehow ruining the sanctity of his marriage. Not that the girlfriend and the kid would have anything to do with ruining the sanctity of said marriage. Had everything to do with those people that he's never going to meet. Because he believed, he internalized it. They're taking this from me. They're going to ruin it. Not that he hadn't ruined it already. And the same thing about on the coal front. You know, these people who have been told for generations, the only thing you've got is coal. You can do nothing else. Your environment can sustain nothing else. It's all we're going to allow you to have. And you better defend it because they're going to come and take it. And of course they're going to be defensive. Of course they're going to say, no, you're not taking what's ours. But I always tell the story of, you know, when we talk to those folks, and you brought up the fact that the people who are preaching the only thing you've got is coal are the people who are ripping them off blindly. Because if you stop and you really think about it, all of the coal, all of the natural gas that has been extracted from under the feet of the citizens of West Virginia and of Pennsylvania, this should be one of the wealthiest states in the country, West Virginia. But what you saw is you saw the wealth being extracted and taken elsewhere. You know, they should have the best schools, the best roads, the best health care. They should have the best of everything because of the amount of wealth that comes out of their ground. Same thing here in Pennsylvania, which is why I'm a huge supporter of an extraction tax, a severance tax, whatever you want to call it, on what comes out from under our ground. They're going to do it. So we should at least have some benefit to it. Where it pays for cleaning up the environment. It pays for cleaning up the environmental degradation and the destruction to our roads and bridges. And, oh, by the way, it pays for an education system that would be second to none so that when it goes away, there's something next. And this is what they have done masterfully to folks in the working class. They said, this is all you've got. You better fight for it before they start taking it away. So over the weekend, it was an excellent conference. And then over the next couple of weeks and months, we're going to go back and look at some of the sessions they had, maybe talk to some of the folks that they had come in from across the country to talk about really important issues. I mean, one of the panels that I sat in on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, very good, and looked at it from a number of different layers. I generally look at things from a worker standpoint. How will these horrible free trade agreements destroy employment and harm workers? But they had a whole different bunch of perspectives, from the environmental side, from the human trafficking side. There was just so much to it. And I think that, you know, going through and expand not just my ideas and my thoughts on this stuff, but also give you the opportunity to call in and really question these folks. They're the experts, and I think the information is that important. I think it's important to have both sides, even if you don't agree, even if you're, hey, we need to have free trade agreements with everybody. Maybe being cognizant of what could be is probably a way to go. Probably a way to go. So, you know, over the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be working on some of that, because there were a lot of really, really articulate speakers and very knowledgeable folks that I look forward to getting on the program. Also, over the weekend, they had a gubernatorial debate. We're going to be talking to a number of gubernatorial candidates here in the next segment. Treasurer Rob McCord is going to join us. We'll talk about his part in the debate. I had a pretty big announcement there at the debate. Tomorrow we'll be talking with Tom Wolf. He is also one of the gubernatorial candidates, and I've got some more in the works. Also, the lieutenant governor's race. They had their debate, which I thought was interesting. And I found it interesting that, you know, in looking at only one person really knew what the lieutenant governor did. And to be honest, I didn't actually know everything the lieutenant governor does. Mostly a ceremonial position, but still, one that you need, I guess. I guess. but it'll be interesting to talk to those folks as well. Because look, those people are one heartbeat away from being the governor. I mean, stop and look at the two we've got now. Not that Corbett is the greatest thing in the world, but imagine one beat away from the governor being Jim Cawley. I think that's a scary proposition in my mind. Now, there's some who think, oh, he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. He wants right to work for nothing. And I don't know many working people who are thrilled about that. But we got so much to get to today. So many thoughts. When you call in, please hold. The auto attendant will pick up and put you on hold. And when I get to a break, I will get to you. Because, like I said, you know, our producer, I'm still in search of a producer. So if you know anybody who's a good producer, we'd love to know. But that's how things are going to go for the next couple of weeks until I find and train someone to take over. So yes. So if you call, stay on hold. The auto attendant will say, hey, thanks for calling. Listen to the phone. I'll be with you in a minute, and I will be. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, hopefully we're going to talk with Treasurer Rob McCord. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Auto Workers is urging the NLRB to apply something called the Westwood Test to the union's challenge of the Chattanooga, Tennessee VW union election results. The five-factor test has been used in past cases to decide whether results were tainted. The UAW says anti-union Tennessee politicians and right-wing groups interfered so much in that election that it created, quote, a general atmosphere of fear of reprisal, rendering a free election impossible, end quote. A right-wing anti-union group is fighting the UAW-NLRB appeal of the election results. The Westwood test arose from a unionization drive at Westwood Horizons Hotel in Los Angeles during the 1980s. In that case, some workers threatened and harassed other workers to pressure them to vote for the union. Workers voted for a union, but the hotel challenged the results, and the NLRB ordered a new election. To meet the Westwood test, The NLRB would have to decide that threats made at the VW plant would affect all voting workers, were widely made, that those making the threats had the power to carry them out, and whether workers acted or voted in fear of the threats, and whether the threats coincided with the election. The UAW has until March 7th to finish making its case, and the NLRB will then decide whether to proceed with the case. Kentucky Republicans have launched an effort to pass so-called right-to-work anti-union legislation in Kentucky. Democrats control the Kentucky House, so passage is unlikely. Kentucky AFL-CIO President Bill Londrigan.
It hurts our financial ability to represent our workers. The whole goal of this thing is to undermine our ability to effectively represent our members. They claim that we are forcing people to be in a union. That is a complete mistruth. We cannot force anybody to be a member of a union. It's against the law. The Supreme Court decided that back in 1963.
U.S. Airways flight attendants have ratified an agreement on bargaining between the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, and the Association of Professional Flight Attendants at American Airlines. It establishes joint bargaining for a single labor contract for flight attendants at American, the world's largest airline. That strengthens solidarity and bargaining leverage for all 24,000 flight attendants at American Airlines. The two unions this week will begin forming a joint bargaining team for an opening proposal to the company, combining the best of both union contracts. On Wednesday, Kentucky civil rights, labor, faith, and other activist groups will commemorate the 50th anniversary of the state's largest civil rights march in Frankfort. The march was led by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. King was pro-union, and he said the labor movement was the principal force that transformed misery and despair into hope and progress. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Do you advocate getting rid of the minimum wage? Would that create more jobs?
Absolutely, and it would help the poor, the people who need a job. The minimum wage is a mandate. We're against mandates, so why should we have it? No, it would be very beneficial.
Everything's raising but the wages. Everything's raising but the wages. Gasoline, groceries, and our haces. Everything's raising but the wages.
I gotta tell you, I love that. I love that position. You know, the minimum wage would be so much better if it didn't exist and those people could work for free. It would help the poor the most because they'd have jobs. That would be fantastic. And I've heard this argument time and time again. Because look, I'm on board with the fast food 15 campaign. Look, I think you can pay everybody a decent living wage. This idea that you work 40 hours and you got to go to your government for help to put food on the table for your kids to get a school lunch is absolutely ridiculous and ludicrous. But over the weekend, at the Keystone Progress Progressive Summit, I sat in on the gubernatorial debate and heard Rob McCord say $10.70 an hour immediately. The highest of any of the other candidates, and immediately you heard one of the candidates say, well, you can't do that, that's bad. But here to tell us about his idea on how we raise the minimum wage and do so many other things in our Commonwealth, I've got Treasurer Rob McCord on the line. Rob, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, you bet. It's my pleasure.
$10.70 an hour, huh? That's going to kill jobs, don't you know? It would be the end of civilization as we know it.
Yeah, I appreciate your sarcasm. And I share your view. And also, I get to be somebody who can say, look, I'm not only proud to be supporting the labor movement, I'm proud that I'm an experienced business leader and investor. I went to Penn's Wharton School, not exactly a place that breeds socialists, right? So the fact is, we looked into this, and you can bet your balance sheet, as they say, that these companies can afford to pay a living wage. And what's interesting about 1070 is that it exactly matches the purchasing power of 1968. And guess what was true in 1968? We thought we were fighting poverty for good. Obviously, you know, we failed, right? We didn't keep up the fight, and corporate interests defeated those who were trying to defend a lot of working poor people, et cetera. But second, back then, even liberal economists bought into this idea that when you raise the minimum wage, you're gonna eliminate at least some jobs. The fact is, the evidence suggests that's simply not true. We're not talking about one or two studies. We're talking about a dozen studies over decades, including studies done in fast food restaurants on either side of the border in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. So this is a very evidence-oriented approach to this. And if you think about it, you know, really methodically, it all makes sense. The fact is the companies that pay minimum wages overall tend to be very wealthy. Think of McDonald's. These are not weak balance sheet companies. The people who accept minimum wages have very little bargaining power, right? They're not organized, unionized, et cetera. So it isn't surprising that when a company like that prices what the market will bear, the lion's share of that profit does not go to the minimum wage worker. So it just is a false assumption that you're going to kill jobs. In fact, you'll create jobs. Why? Because more wages will be staying right here in Pennsylvania as opposed to porting that money out to Arkansas and other states to the corporate balance sheets. And that money gets spent in the economy because these people tend to spend 95 cents on the dollar that they earn. So in the long run, you would actually create more jobs with this faster boost in what is still an understimulated economy, especially at the low end for working families.
Well, it's about time someone gets that. I mean, I have a fairly well-to-do uncle who says it doesn't matter what you set the minimum wage at, I'm still going to get all the money. So set it what you want. Because his theory is and I think as you've aptly pointed out, you give folks at the bottom of the economic scale money, they spend it, put it back into the economy. People who own businesses, like my very well-to-do uncle, he creates a product that they want, they give him the money back. It seems fairly
right.
Simple.
I mean, and I don't, you know, this is one that really has been studied like crazy, and we can do a lot of good for working people who are working hard and playing by the rules. And I think there are out there a bunch of people who say, by the way, isn't it better for our civilization that we pay people a living wage than have them work more than full time and still need to go on food stamps or on federal assistance for health care, right? So it absolutely makes sense from more than one angle that we do this. And I'm proud, frankly, to have had a more assertive policy than any of my competitors in saying, let's go to 1070, not 1010, and let's make the move right away in year one. My competitors seem to wrap themselves around a plan that said, we'll lift the rate slowly as if it was in some way dangerous to these strong balance sheet companies. And guess what? In year one, it's a $5,200 difference.
Yeah.
Imagine a poor working mother working hard and playing by the rules and the difference that $5,200 in that household can make. It's a big difference.
It's a huge difference. And then imagine from the taxpayer standpoint of all of the companies who are now paying wages that are well above the poverty line. So no longer do kids have to stand in lunch lines asking for a handout. No longer do we have to have EBT cards and have people looking sideways at these folks who are working. It seems like a win-win proposition all the way across the board for me.
That's exactly right. And look, we studied this carefully, and we double-checked. We checked the data. We checked the studies. We checked the, you know, what challenge would develop if you did it slowly versus quickly. And it absolutely made sense for the Pennsylvania economy to defend working families and working people. And remember, 60% of these working people at minimum wage are women. You've got a ton of people who are working women with kids. You're doing the right thing for children. You're doing the right thing for women. You're doing the right thing for the Pennsylvania economy.
Oh, hold on. That's not what I heard. I heard it was mostly pimply-faced teenagers and granny who needed bingo money. That's what I've been told the minimum wage workforce is.
Yeah, and that's just wrong. When you actually look at the data, you know, especially the tipped workforce is women, and we need to do everything we can to lift that rate. But in general, it's only a minority of the workers who are students, and you can exempt them and recognize that it's a different pay rate for students, but the fact is you cannot populate all of these jobs with students. It simply isn't available. And that's the reason that you've seen some of the larger corporate interests trying to step on the brakes here. And we're very mindful that we're doing a lot more for working people. The vast majority of people who are making the minimum wage are adults. The majority of those adults, of course, are women, and we're immediately lifting thousands of families out of poverty in year one by taking the approach we embrace.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Treasurer Rob McCord, running for governor on the Democratic side. The website, robmccord.com, Twitter handle, robmccordpa, also his Facebook, facebook.com/robmccordpa. We've got links at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Rob's name. I'll take you right there. You brought up students. And I look at the governor that we have, and look, I think all of the Democratic candidates in the debate on Saturday in Harrisburg were all on board with funding education. But I look at this governor and the $1 billion each year he's gutted from public education, and I can only, you know, look at something that you said, that the scheme that we've seen in our prison system is crony capitalism. You look at what's going on with the privatization of education. I can only argue that that's crony capitalism as well. I'm curious, if Governor McCord were in office, what are we doing with public education?
Well, it is my highest priority by far. Clearly what happened with Tom Corbett is he came into office and the first thing to cut was public education. If in a McCord administration, it's the first thing to fund. And frankly, it's the first thing to invest in. And it's important that we use the right verb here. Governor Corbett, perhaps reflecting his background as a career bureaucrat and politician, would talk about the spend number and how we, quote, held the line on a spend number, close quote, instead of talking about investments. And the fact is, sometimes there is spending. One hopes that it's spending for fairness issues. But sometimes there is investing, and it's investments that yield a return. And if you're lucky, a very steep return. So, you know, it'd be as if you go into a household and you regard every check that's cut out of a checkbook as identical in its importance. And it's like, look, the check you write to go on a vacation or to buy an extra, you know, an extra nice set of shoes is different from the check that you write to pay your daughter's college tuition, or to pay for repair of your roof, or to fund your retirement account, or to put money into savings for a rainy day. And what's happened with this governor is he's literally defunded rainy day savings. He's closing deals by deferring, by giving away tax write-offs. In other words, it's the same as borrowing money. He's doing a lot of off-balance sheet debt. His supposed pension reform actually increases the cost of pensions while reducing the pension benefits to be paid to seniors by $12,000 a year. So it's, you know, they're just mistake after mistake, and it's clear we can do better. And what we're, the McCord candidacy is built on the notion that having a business leader who has experience creating jobs in the business world, also experience as an independently elected treasurer, protecting seniors, protecting students, protecting working people, and frankly, protecting people from Tom Corbett. As a good fiscal watchdog, I'm the person who's spent by far the most time fighting and defeating Tom Corbett. And that's resonating with a lot of Democrats who are saying job one is to defeat and evict Corbett, and McCord knows how to do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I got to be honest. I'm with you on the, we got to get McCord, we've got to get Corbett out of office. There's no question
right
about that, because I've yet to see anything positive come about from it. Look, when he took office, you could make the argument, okay, the state was in a little problem thanks to the Bush collapse. We had some pension problems. We've got some budget problems thanks to an economy that collapsed because of bad conservative policy, in my view. And I get the, okay, we got to tighten our belt a little bit because tomorrow is going to be better. I keep seeing the belt getting tighter and tighter and tighter. I'm not seeing anything getting better.
Well, and also, look, we have what sometimes some people would call a reasonable comparison. They're starting to have surpluses in Republican as well as Democratic states across the country. You know, whether you're looking at states like Wisconsin or California or New York, you see a compare and contrast, right? You see a reasonable comparison. And the fact is, Tom Corbett gave away tax breaks on a crony capitalist basis to a few corporate interests, claiming it would create jobs. It failed to create jobs, but it did create red ink. So he created his own structural deficit, and he never engaged in the quest for evidence, right? And the evidence shows it was a bad move. And what's really frightening is we're not just sucking air, dropping from top tier to bottom tier in overall job creation. we're actually doing badly even in the business world of job creation. Among mid-Atlantic states, we're doing terribly. And in area after area, you look at sort of common sense comparisons. The fact that the Republican governors of Ohio and New Jersey accepted the expansion of Medicaid in part because their taxpayers have already paid for it. It's the right thing to do because the federal government's giving you 100% reimbursement. And oh, by the way, drum roll, please, it creates tens of thousands of jobs. So, you know, Governor Corbett has sort of proven himself to be incompetent. But I also, Rick, will sort of add to this for your listeners, you know, the question, why bother getting involved in the primary? And there are a couple of core answers. The first is to nominate the person who is most likely to defeat Tom Corbett when we're fully engaged in the general election debate. And having somebody like me who's a self-made business person, well, self-made plus public education, who's created thousands of jobs in the business world in a lot of different industries or helped to create them, and who's proven himself as a statewide independent elected leader who can get things done in a tough town like Harrisburg is important. And it's important that we elect a governor who won't be another governor gridlock, a governor who can get things done in Harrisburg, because so much of this job creation involves having a governor who would know how to invest and innovate. And the experience we bring not just to the campaign but to governing, both business experience and governing experience, is what's pulling so many people towards our candidacy.
It's interesting you brought up the gridlock situation in Harrisburg, and you blamed, on Saturday, you blamed Corbett for the gridlock in Harrisburg. And what I find interesting is the Republicans control everything. They control the House, they control the Senate, they control the governor's mansion, and by sizable steamroller margins, yet they can't even get the ugly stuff, fortunately, the ugly stuff that they want done, because those ideas are so bad.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And look, I hesitate to use the word blame. I always try to use the word accountability. I mean, what you want on a purely non-ideological basis out of your government, right, is honesty, efficiency, and accountability.
Right.
Period, right? I mean, honesty, efficiency, and accountability. Nobody should be arguing with that. And what's spooky about the current governor is he won't stand up and face the facts that he's the one who's driven up a real deficit in Pennsylvania when compared to other states, that he's the one who led us from 7th to below 47th in job creation, that he's the one who said there would be tons of private sector jobs if he just gave some corporate interests specially tailored tax cuts. It did not work. And in the meantime, you've got a larger and larger group of Pennsylvanians who are working twice as hard to get half as far. They're working twice as hard to pay their bills. They're succeeding just barely in paying their bills, only to see college affordability go down, and more importantly, their state and local governments failing to fund public education, to invest in public education. So they aren't seeing their partners in the public sector honor the big contract, the social contract that we have. And, you know, when I hold Tom Corbett accountable, I am simply saying that's what all governors ought to be held accountable for. And let's face it, when you have a legislature that's all your party, the leader of the party should be held accountable for whether or not you're getting this important work done. And he's just failing miserably.
Now, I'm with you. One of the other things I did want to ask you about is you got your zinger in, and it was a good one, that you said the governor is owned by the J.R. Ewing wing of the Republican Party. Explain that.
Well, I believe that one of the things you have to do when you're a leader is work hard to earn trust. And it was in the context of talking about energy and Marcella Shale and whether or not to have a full moratorium. And it's like, look, we can embrace the energy boom, but it should be part of an all of the above approach to energy strategy. We should be mindful of the opportunity to fuel manufacturing in Pennsylvania and give a special advantage to manufacturers in Pennsylvania because of natural gas. We should be addressing natural gas prudently and responsibly as a potential bridge fuel as we try to work to reduce the carbon footprint of Pennsylvania, which is 1% of all global climate emissions, as well as our nation as a whole. And if that's it, your approach, that it's a bridge fuel, you take a different approach than you would if it's just drill, baby, drill. This Commonwealth, this state, has had both a good history and a bad history. Its bad history has involved the kind of dine and dash approach where people come in and tear out natural resources, whether it's been timber, coal, or oil. And they don't leave an escrow account, right? They don't leave a rainy day fund behind. They don't leave a permanent fund behind. And you have large corporate interests tearing out these natural resources without paying any kind of an extraction tax. And they leave their wealthy and Pennsylvania's poor. On the other hand, back in the days of Governor Casey, we became a pro-environment commonwealth. We started holding corporate interests accountable for things like hazardous waste. We started respecting local zoning more. We started inspecting a lot of what's going on in various ecosystems across the Commonwealth. And we were getting better and better, and we were embracing an all of the above approach to energy that was job creating. And had that been done hand in hand with having Marcellus Shale, but also having an extraction tax, we would have been able to create a permanent fund that would have done things like funding public education instead of eviscerating it. So what happened with Tom Corbett is he now has people calling for or moratoriums, in part because quite legitimately they just don't trust Tom.
Right.
So you need to build trust instead of acting like you're again sort of a wholly owned subsidiary of the J.R. Ewing wing of the energy industry. And the reason I jokingly say the J.R. Ewing wing is I'm reminding people that there are responsible producers in the energy world, responsible producers that the labor world works well with, and people who continuously improve when it comes to inspection and safety standards, and people who welcome prudent environmental regulation and inspection because it protects them from the irresponsible wildcatters out there. But Tom Corbett has turned away from those to kind of deal, to be overly generous to the less responsible few, in my view.
Hey, listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Treasurer Rob McCord. Again, the website, robmccord.com. Twitter handle, @RobMcCordPA. Facebook.com/ Rob McCord, PA. We've got links all at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Rob's name. It'll take you right there. Last line of questioning I've got for you, because you brought up the Wild West, if you will, of energy. And a lot of conversation lately over what's going on with electricity. And I know that the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission has received somewhere near 3,000 complaints this year alone from folks who feel like they're being ripped off because, hey, Pennsylvania has deregulated energy. And I remember back in the 90s when they were pushing for this, the commercials where people were going, well, you know, people go to heaven and God says, where do you think you are, Pennsylvania? Well, you know what? I've got to be honest with you. People are getting ripped off. So I'm curious first what your thoughts are, and if you think this is just people are too stupid to realize what variable rate contracts mean, or what's your thought?
First of all, I believe responsible business leadership always depends on responsible behavior from the public sector. Good innovation and job creation actually requires prudent regulation. And a lot of the, I will try to say this affectionately, a lot of my Republican opponents out there, they have never really met a payroll or run a business or employed people. They're career politicians who govern by talking point, right? The people who, and I have plenty of friends on the Republican side of the aisle, the ones who've owned businesses and run businesses very often are the ones who are more moderate, who say some reasonable level of regulation or government involvement isn't necessarily a bad thing. And that's what you're finding with things like the utility bills. It's simply farcical to think that the average consumer is going to sit there and read a 32-page document. You know, not everybody out there is an energy lawyer. And we long ago recognized there's something called a public good, meaning we all benefit from all of us having access to it. Guess what those things include? Military defense, clean water, public education, and, drum roll please, access to energy and electricity. There is a public interest in having access to these things. And, you know, the idea that you're going to allow spikes of profit to arrive to the few and pretend that that's in the public interest, it has proven itself to be farcical. And, you know, I actually, when you say too smart, et cetera, I think about my mom and a lot of what motivated me to run, first for treasurer and now for governor, is what my mom went through. And fundamentally, my mom was one of those super smart people. Not many women went to college, who were born in 1930, went to college at all, let alone to Stanford. She went to Stanford. She married a guy who played football. My father, she helped put him through graduate school by teaching public school. This happened to a lot of women in the late 50s and early 60s. After helping support their husband, the wheels fly off. And, again, I will be confessional here and say I'll bet you some people know people like this. Yeah. My dad was a smart guy, but he's also Scotch-Irish type, so he was, athletic, charismatic, alcoholic. She kind of kicks him out for the drinking. She almost gets evicted by Stanford administration. And she was, after finishing her PhD, a union, by the way, kept her in that home. A union kept her in her home in California. She wanted to get out of California when she got her PhD. She was going to go to New York. And she got a call from a friend in Pennsylvania and said, you got to check it out. It's more affordable. It's wonderful. And your sons can take advantage of this great public school system. And it was Pennsylvania public education that rescued me and took me from the slow reading group and undiagnosed dyslexia into getting a lot of financial aid to go to Harvard and live the American dream and help to create jobs. Well, one of the things my mom used to, push me around about in her assertive way is she would say, sometimes you study all this economic theory at Harvard or whatever, and you think it's a fact, but you'd better look at the evidence. And guess about one of the areas where she was right and I was wrong.
What's that?
Around 1980, everybody thought deregulating everything was great for everybody because it would drive pricing down. For example, with airline tickets, aviation deregulation. Well, geniuses like me in 1980, right, when I was in the middle of college, we forgot to take a look at the other unanticipated consequences. So like when Pittsburgh International Airport stops having flights because of hub and spoke, airline worlds, because of deregulation, that hurts all the economies in Western Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And that's what happens time and again when these, I'm going to say it about myself, these snotty-nosed kids, right, because that's what I was in 1980, say, well, it worked on the chalkboard in a theory class, so it will work in general. No, we have to double-check and look at the evidence and make sure we're protecting working people and people who are having trouble paying their bills. If we do that, if we check for that, we're much more likely to do the right thing.
And that's what I want out of my political leader, someone who, A, is able to say when he's wrong and to be able to correct it, and someone who's going to be thoughtful and go, we're not just going to jump into the fad of the day.
Right. I mean, for example, with Tom Corbett, had he said, look, I tried these tax cuts, they didn't work, so I'm doing this other move.
Yep.
But instead, he just says, we did it because, literally, he said this in one of his speeches, all I had to hear was that this would create jobs, and I said, let's do it. And it's like, well, Tom, you did it 3 years ago, it didn't work. Has anybody briefed you on that? not everything you try works.
Well,
so
it's like
my hope is that people, when they look at a McCord candidacy, they're going to say, look, there's a self-made guy who kind of knows what economic security looks and feels like because of what his mom went through and what he went through when he was a little boy. But he also knows what it's like to get the best in the world education because of Pennsylvania public education and some fine, great schools. And he knows what it's like to work with powerful people. He knows how to be garrulous and friendly and to show people the carrot and the incentives. But he also will fight for us. He will fight for working people, and frankly, we know he can fight and defeat Tom Corbett because he keeps doing it. He's been doing it in Harrisburg, most recently around the crony capitalist privatization of the lottery, where I protected senior citizens and Tom Corbett would have hurt them. That's sort of at the very core of our candidacy.
And I appreciate you doing that. And Rob, always great talking with you. Please come back and talk to us again real soon. I wish you nothing but the best of luck.
You got it, Rick. Thanks for all your work.
Thanks so much. Again, the website, robmccord.com, Twitter handle, at robmccordpa, facebook.com/robmccordpa. We've got links at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
reason and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
Ted Nugent, the old rocker from the 70s, is now just plain old, an office rocker. A political novelty act for the far right and a front man for the National Rifle Association, Nugent regularly spews venomous, vulgar, race-laced, abusive hate speech about liberals, Democrats, gun laws, and creeping communism. In January, for example, he tongue-lashed President Obama, calling him a, quote, communist-raised, communist-educated, communist-nurtured, subhuman mongrel. So, naturally, this scurrilous lout was promptly invited to come to Texas by the leading Republican candidate for governor. It seems that Greg Abbott, currently the state attorney general and a dyed-in-the-wool Tea Party extremist, thought it would juice up his far-out GOP flock to have the rabidly nutty Nugent come campaign with him. Ted came, even embracing the gubernatorial wannabe as his, quote, blood brother. But the brotherhood gambit backfired. Even Republican leaders wondered aloud why Abbott would, as one put it, keep company with a noted misogynist and bigot. In addition to Nugent's disgusting subhuman mongrel slur, the old rocker is also well known for being a sexual predator of underage girls. The issue, however, is not Nugent's sordid character, but Abbott's. Hugging an infamous predator and hate monger for political gain is both morally repugnant and politically stupid. Yet, Abbott continues to cling to Nugent's embrace, tersely and cluelessly saying, it's time to move beyond this. A campaign aide even tried to paint Nugent's endorsement as a positive. We appreciate the support of everyone who supports protecting our Constitution. This is Jim Hightower saying, everyone? Sexual predators? Overt racists? Mass murderers? Shouldn't a candidate for governor, even in Texas, draw a sharper moral line than he loves the Second Amendment?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
Southern tomato growers had a pretty good gig going in the early 1800s, selling their produce to northern states. The northern states offered a great market for all the tomatoes grown in the South, but the Civil War provided a difficult interruption. During the war, the North had to import tomatoes from elsewhere, and they did quite well, importing primarily from Bermuda and the Bahamas. When the war between the states ended, southern tomato growers desperately wanted their U.S. market back. So they lobbied Congress in Washington to put a tariff on imported vegetables, which would make their U.S. tomatoes cheaper, and they succeeded. The Tariff Act of 1883 imposed a tax on imported vegetables, but specifically exempted fruits, green, ripe, or dried. The tomato growers were pleased, and of course, the importers were not happy. Join us again for the case of Nix versus Heaven. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Minimum wage! Yeah!
You know what it means when they pay you minimum wage? You know what they're trying to tell you? It's like, hey, if I could pay you less, I would.
Oh, yeah. That's not the truth. And, you know, I love this idea. Really, I do. I love this idea that... And look, good on Rob McCord for this idea that we're going to immediately, and I didn't ask, and during the break it kicked me in the behind that I didn't, and I'm sure it does, but I didn't ask if his minimum wage increase up to $10.70 an hour would have been tied with an inflation index adjustment every year. So that we don't have to have these fights every 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years as inflation has eroded on the minimum wage down to, you know, the poverty wages again. To me, I go back and I think about a friend of mine who went through the University of Michigan all the way from, you know, being a freshman, a lowly freshman, to graduating with a law degree, working a minimum wage waitress job, having her own apartment, having her own car, paying all of her costs, having health insurance, and graduating with the little cardboard cap and the little gown and all of the little tassels and all of that stuff, debt-free. And not because mommy and daddy had lots of money, and not because they got tons of, like, she got tons of loans and all, debt free. Just working the part-time job, put enough money on the, keep the little apartment, keep the little car, nothing great. Not the Taj Mahal, not a Bentley, not a Maybach, no, none of that. Cheap little car, cheap little apartment, paid for her college out of her own pocket. All the way through to a law degree, no debt. Because at the time, we were investing in education. At the time, minimum wage wasn't a poverty wage. It was something you could live on. And people did. Today, you know, what do you got? You've got these folks who think that they're so much better. And I had this conversation over the weekend that really has stuck with me. As I, on my weekend, my driving gig on the weekend that I enjoy doing, I get to meet so many different people. And one guy that I see every Sunday, you know, we've gotten into this habit of going back and forth on an issue. And he asked me about minimum wage. And I said, you know, when you've got an industry like the fast food industry that you're subsidizing with several billion dollars, I think, and they're very profitable in the $7 to $8 billion per quarter range. Don't you think that they can pay a decent wage? And it comes back to this, well, this is what the market has decided. I'm going, no, there's no such thing as the free market. If there was such a thing as a free market, then you wouldn't have to work, right? The reality is you have to work, so there's nothing free about your participation in the quote-unquote market. Because in order for there to be free will and free choice in the free market, you have to have the freedom to abstain. Right? You have to be able to weigh the options, whether it's worth my time or it's not. And the ability to abstain. That's really part of the free market. And we don't have that. You have to work. Because in order to eat, you have to have money. And in order to get money, you generally have to work. Unless you qualify under one of the very, very arduous processes of getting some type of assistance. He came out with a zinger that caught my attention. Because he said, well, we shouldn't worry about what the companies make. We shouldn't worry about what the Ray Crocs of the world and the Waltons of the world make. We shouldn't worry about them. And I said, well, we're guaranteeing corporate profits. And he said, well, if we don't guarantee their profits, they won't stay in business and we won't have jobs. And I'm going, do you really believe that if they went out of business, nothing else would prop up in their place? That if you had honest, true competition and not massive monopoly, that you wouldn't have the ability to compete? And thus the ability to then, in a quote-unquote free market, choose? And, you know, he said no. He actually believed, and this stopped me in my tracks. After saying that I have socialistic tendencies, that I care about workers too much, that he believed that we should be guaranteeing corporate profits. Let that sink in for a second, because I think it's important to really grasp the gravity of that statement. That he honestly believes that we should, by all ways possible, ensure that these corporations, that they that they are profitable at all costs, and whatever that means. Now, as I look at this, we've heard the reports, we've heard the most recent, you know, screeds from the mount, from the right, that, oh, we're going to lose jobs. And I think Rob McCord hit it right on. There have been numerous studies that said the job loss, extraordinarily minimal, if at all. The jobs lost are generally made up by new jobs. And the studies that I've read have actually shown over the time, over a short period of time after the increase in the minimum wage, you see an actual increase in employment. Because it's common sense. It's common sense in that more people have money in their pocket, larger sums, and they're able to spend a little bit more money. And that creates economic activity. And I'm not sure Rob wanted to go with me with my uncle's belief that as a rich person, all the money all comes back to him anyway. So it doesn't matter what we do down here. It all comes back to him anyway, because he's the business owner. And there's a thought, there's a school of thought to that. And that's, understand, that's what trickle-down economics was really founded on. That the wealth, we would give all the wealth to the people at the top, it would trickle down to us, and then we would spend it, and then that would create, it would be this reverberating cycle. Problem is we've paid homage to the chair upward, and they've hoarded it. And it hasn't really trickled down to us. It hasn't really gotten into the pockets of the people who create the wealth. And a little bit later in the program, in the third hour, we're going to talk to a UPMC worker. I'll get it right one of these times. University of Pittsburgh Medical Center workers who are out in the streets today saying, you know what? We're making billions of dollars for this global company. We're making billions of dollars of profit for this company that's paying their CEOs tens of millions of dollars. And yet, we've got folks who are actually making that money for these CEOs and these executives not being able to put food on their own tables, not being able to get the health care that they need if they get sick. And there's something seriously wrong with this whole picture. And, I had gotten into this weird Twitter battle with somebody saying, well, I'm paid fairly and not near poverty wages, and I work for UPMC. Turns out he works, according to what I could find out, he's a marketing pro, he says. So he works in the marketing, the communications part of the business. And he kept wanting me to tell him that his job was not important. And I'm not going to say that. His job may be important. But on the grand scheme of things to the sick people in the hospital, is it important? Probably not. What's important is that person that's taking care of them isn't sick, isn't poverty-ridden, isn't sickly, is stable, professional. But here we go. And we're going to see more of this stuff coming in the days, weeks, and months as the wealth class feels cornered and feels trapped. They're going to be pushing for more right-to-work laws. They're going to be pushing for more assaults on workers' ability to collective bargaining. They're going to push as hard as they can to take what little opportunity workers in this country have to organize, which is why I think this election cycle, and I suggest you take a look at all the Democratic gubernatorial candidates up in this cycle and say, hey, you know what? Which one is going to be best for the Commonwealth? Which one's going to be best for working people? And cast your vote in November. And look at the Corbett record. I got to be honest with you. Nothing, in my view, all that great with the Corbett record. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
All about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Auto Workers is urging the NLRB to apply something called the Westwood Test to the union's challenge of the Chattanooga, Tennessee VW union election results. The five-factor test has been used in past cases to decide whether results were tainted. The UAW says anti-union Tennessee politicians and right-wing groups interfered so much in that election that it created, quote, a general atmosphere of fear of reprisal, rendering a free election impossible, end quote. A right-wing anti-union group is fighting the UAW-NLRB appeal of the election results. The Westwood test arose from a unionization drive at Westwood Horizons Hotel in Los Angeles during the 1980s. In that case, some workers threatened and harassed other workers to pressure them to vote for the union. Workers voted for a union, but the hotel challenged the results, and the NLRB ordered a new election. To meet the Westwood test, the NLRB would have to decide that threats made at the VW plant would affect all voting workers, were widely made, that those making the threats had the power to carry them out, and whether workers acted or voted in fear of the threats, and whether the threats coincided with the election. The UAW has until March 7th to finish making its case, and the NLRB will then decide whether to proceed with the case. Kentucky Republicans have launched an effort to pass so-called right-to-work anti-union legislation in Kentucky. Democrats control the Kentucky House, so passage is unlikely. Kentucky AFL-CIO President Bill Londrigan.
It hurts our financial ability to represent our workers. The whole goal of this thing is to undermine our ability to effectively represent our members. They claim that we are forcing people to be in a union. That is a complete mistruth. We cannot force anybody to be a member of a union. It's against the law. The Supreme Court decided that back in 1963.
U.S. Airways flight attendants have ratified an agreement on bargaining between the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, and the Association of Professional Flight Attendants at American Airlines. It establishes joint bargaining for a single labor contract for flight attendants at American, the world's largest airline. That strengthens solidarity and bargaining leverage for all 24,000 flight attendants at American Airlines. The two unions this week will begin forming a joint bargaining team for an opening proposal to the company, combining the best of both union contracts. On Wednesday, Kentucky civil rights, labor, faith, and other activist groups will commemorate the 50th anniversary of the state's largest civil rights march in Frankfort. The march was led by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. King was pro-union, and he said the labor movement was the principal force that transformed misery and despair into hope and progress. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Yeah, you're looking for experience. You're looking for someone with a proven track record. With the climate change about man-made global warming in this country. And everybody rushed to say, oh, we need to do something now about this huge problem. I didn't change. I stood tall and said,
this is the end.
This climate science of man-made global warming was not climate science, it was political science.
I gotta tell you, the more I hear that clip, the more I hear Santorum, Mr. Head in the Sand. I expect it from him. I expect stupid from there. But the people who clapped, going, yeah, it's not climate science, political science, yeah, clack. That's what scares me. And, even if you're not, someone, because look, I'm not a climate scientist. I don't spend every day of my life studying this stuff, but it seems logical. And wouldn't you just, as a matter of common sense, start thinking about how can we do things differently and do things better? Just a thought. And I look at our weather, and one of my friends asked me the other day, is Pennsylvania, are Pennsylvanians ready for Maine-like weather? Because the South here in the country is having to get used to Pennsylvania-like weather. And that's an interesting question, which is why we've asked John Eckeson to come talk with us. He's Energy Policy Director for the Nebraska Wildlife Federation. NebraskaWildlife.org is their website. John, thanks for taking time for us.
It's a pleasure, Rick. Good to be here.
I listen to someone like Rick Santorum say, it's not climate science, it's political science, and very proud of the fact that his head is completely, somewhere.
Somewhere dark.
Somewhere very dark. I wasn't sure how to put that nicely or in a very genteel way, but the reality is the guy's head is up his behind.
Yep.
But what scares me are the people in that room, the people who cheer this stuff and say, no, it's not real, no, it's all made up. But you look at the wild swings that we've had, the massive amount of snow and the massive amount of swings in temperatures, and something's got to be going on, John.
You're absolutely right. That is one of the key indicators, what the real scientists call a fingerprint. That the things they predicted, and they not only predict it, but they can tell you why they predicted it. And when they get something wrong, they can figure out what they got wrong and why. And a real scientist, will do that. In fact, talking about this crazy weather and this polar vortex, which is making everybody crazy, there is a genuine controversy as opposed to the ones that people like Santorum and his people cook up to pretend controversy. There are real scientists actually arguing about the theory that the polar vortex, which really is the warping of the jet stream, is that a direct consequence of the loss of Arctic ice and other changes in the Arctic humidity and so forth caused by global warming. And that's a really interesting debate, and you can hear some of it on the Inquiring Minds podcast at Mother Jones and other places. But that's, there's a difference between the real controversy and these fantasies they cook up to play gotcha.
Right. So is it
these
real?
Really interesting.
I mean, is it real? I mean, because there are some people, like, look, I'm not a scientist. Your argument and the climate change people's arguments make perfect sense to me. But from my point of view is, well, I can't say emphatically because I don't do the research, it seems logical. And if it seems logical, shouldn't we be moving away from what it is that we're doing to maybe try and slow it down if we can? I mean, is it already too late?
Well, we've already baked into the pie some change, and we're seeing that. Especially in 2012, a lot of us got a tremendous shock from just the feeble little beginnings of climate changes. And you're right, we know what causes it. You put too many greenhouse gases, an unnatural amount of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, like carbon dioxide and water vapor and these other methane. Which is the main part of the natural gas. You put enough of that stuff in the atmosphere, and it doesn't take much, and you start to warm things up, and then that starts to do things like melt reflective ice, which absorbs more heat, and these are called feedback loops. And the feedback loops get going, and we get warmer and warmer. I think we have two things. We can first of all perform the duck test, which is sort of what you were talking about before. If it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a damn duck. And the climate scientists, they have to be very careful, very precise, very qualified. And, of course, a propagandist who wants to deny the science, they can use that and come in and say, well, they're not sure. No, excuse me, they're just being scientists. But us guys, we got to say, it's a duck. We need to cut the greenhouse gases by stop burning so much coal and natural gas. And go with wind and solar, and it's not rocket science at that point. We know what to do. It just takes the political will to do it, and that's the political story.
Yeah, I mean, but the reality is there's too much money and too much profit in status quo. There's too much special interest in the status quo, and which is why I think you see this huge pushback and all of the propaganda and all the rhetoric and all of the – look, what you're talking about, the change of moving to wind and solar and conservation, heaven forbid, and maybe not using as much energy, it's going to be, I think, it's going to be a painful transition, right?
Well, it'll be painful for the people who won't make buku bucks anymore. For the rest of us, it'll be really sweet because of a couple of things. As you point out, conservation is key. The cheapest energy is the stuff you never use. So you never have to make it, so you never have to pay for it. How cool is that? I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Everybody else does too. And there's no reason we can't do that if we decide to. There are plenty of examples in American history in particular where people say, oh, it's impossible. You ragtag colonists cannot defeat the most powerful empire ever on the planet, and yet, you know, the Brits learned a lesson there. On and on and on, time after time after time, we do the impossible. People say, this is impossible, too much money. Well, there's too much to lose. It will cost so much more to not correct the climate disruption from global warming than it will to correct it. There's a path to prosperity there to switch to new forms of energy. That's a lot of work that needs to be done and a lot of, frankly, some money to be made and a lot of jobs to be had and a lot of economic stability through the transition to the new economy.
Yeah,
who loses,
the entrenched powers. I look at our governor here in Pennsylvania. The fact is this governor has destroyed thousands of good-paying solar industry jobs by allowing the solar renewable energy credits to bottom out and the entire solar industry to die in this state because, well, he's... I think, as our guest in the last hour pointed out, bought and paid for by the J.R. Ewing wing of the Republican Party.
Well, let me give you some good news on the governor's situation. I'm in Nebraska. As you may be aware, there's a foreign corporation by the name of TransCanada that is bound and determined to buy off every politician along the proposed pipeline route for its Keystone XL pipeline. And that thing was supposed to be done, buried, and pumping dilbit from Alberta to Texas for export a couple of years ago.
Yep.
People said, you can't stop that. Whatever big oil wants, they're going to get. Well, we have stopped it every day since they said it was impossible. And just last week, we won a pretty darn good victory because TransCanada had been very generous with our legislature, the senators, and surely I wouldn't suggest there's any connection between that and the fact that they passed some special legislation to make it easier for them to put their pipeline through. But last week, a judge overturned that, told the governor to go back to the his corner, quit trying to rewrite the Constitution. The pipeline has to be approved by a public service commission. We won that one. People said it was impossible. We did it anyway, and that was the governor in a red state of Nebraska.
Let me ask you about that, since you brought up the Keystone Pipeline. You know, I've said from the beginning I'm against building it all the way to Texas. If we're going to have the environmental degradation, we're going to have our country, you know, the environment destroyed, we should benefit from it. And my position has always been, if you're going to build it, it should only be to Chicago or somewhere like that, where you refine it there, and it only stays here in the U.S., which I do know will never happen because they'll never allow that. But you know, what harm is it going to do much beyond what we've already done? In your expert opinion.
Well, I wrote an op-ed piece for the Lincoln Journal Star, the capital city paper here, a couple of years ago, and pointed out that no matter where the dilbit comes from, no matter how it gets to where it's going, pipeline, rail, truck. And no matter what country ends up burning the end product, it will all end up in the atmosphere, and it will be a very important key part of roasting us. So, you know, the big picture matters a lot more than the details. But the details are where we've stopped it cold. And right now, it's the supposedly redneck ranchers and farmers and landowners in Nebraska who have come to be pretty good buddies with the greenies and the liberals and the left-wingers in the eastern urban part of the state. It is these ordinary people who have taken this huge oil company, pipeline company from Canada, and brought them to a complete halt. They tried to bully these people, and let me tell you, you don't bully these ranchers out there.
Yeah.
It gets them kind of pissed off. It's not a good idea.
Yeah. Well, I mean, radical self-interest has a real motivating factor, and you find friends wherever you can. So let me ask you, with these ranchers, is it the fact that, because I look at it two different ways, is it the fact that this pipeline is going to come right through their land and infringe on their property, or is it because massive droughts and all of that are drying up their land? Which side do you see them picking from, or both?
Yes. You know, it's sort of a classic organizing story, classic learning exercise for people where you start out and that's exactly where it was. They're bullying me. I do not like them. My neighbors, some people have stolen the lease because they've been threatened, but I'm going to stand firm. And then you find out who stands with you to defend your own right to your property against a foreign corporation who claims to be able to come in and just tell you to move over. We'll give you a few $1,000s, and you give us the right to threaten your land in perpetuity with the horrible spills of dilbit like they've done in other places. And over time, you learn. You listen to people. You talk to people that you would never in a million years have been drinking a beer with before. And it changes you. People change in action, and they change by doing things. And they're like, Nebraskans ain't stupid. You know, they learn, they see what's going on, and there's a lifelong Republican, literally the poster child for this campaign, is an old rancher by the name of Randy Thompson, lifelong Republican, you know, he's arm in arm, you know, with people that, you know, 5 years ago he would thought was his enemies, but he's finding out are his friends.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with John Atkinson. He's the Energy Policy Director for the Nebraska Wildlife Federation. Their website, nebraskawildlife.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Let me ask you this, John. You know, yesterday we were supposed to get a foot of snow. The weather service got it really completely wrong, and you got the local newspaper going, well, how could they get it so wrong? I mean, we've had record amounts of snow. The temperatures have gone crazy. Is this the new normal that we're going to, here in Pennsylvania and then in the South, where they're getting snow where they never had before, really? Is this the new normal for the U.S.?
Well, the new normal is not knowing what to expect, I think. There's certain general patterns that are pretty easy to predict, that there are going to be more extremes. They will be more difficult to spot on a short-term basis. The long-term patterns are changing. The territory of the old Dust Bowl of the 30s, we're looking at a new Dust Bowl, this time permanent. The warping of the jet stream that gives us the so-called polar vortex. Well, you know, there's very, very qualified climate scientists that operate at a high level who disagree how much that is connected to the melting of the Arctic ice, but you know it's connected.
Right.
The mechanism of connection, and can you use that to predict that what's going to happen? You get into the details, and you don't know what the heck's going on sometimes, because climate is the general pattern, and weather is what happens every day. They all say it. Climate is what you expect. Weather is what you get. So we know winter is colder than summer, but we also don't know which winter is going to be a cold winter or a warmer winter or a wetter winter or a drier winter any specific year. But we do know that already, if you look back over the last 40 years, in almost every location in the country, and certainly interior, away from the buffering influence of the ocean and the Gulf, that if you look back over 40 years, we used to get a lot of weather like this. What makes us nuts today is that we're no longer used to it. We are no longer prepared for it. And so we get buried in snow. We no longer have that many snow plows. We don't have that much salt. We don't, you know, the kids, when I was a kid growing up in the mountains of Virginia, we used to know we would have to get 2-3 feet of snow before we would get out of school.
Yep.
You know, and now it's big headlines if you get it anytime.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about that because a lot of people say, you know, when I was a kid, you had massive snowstorms. You had some fluctuations of weather. I just don't ever remember as a kid being in December, being 50 degrees in December, and then a week later having a foot of snow. I don't remember these wild swings.
Last night, I'll take it back. When I woke up this morning, it was -5 degrees in Lincoln, Nebraska. And that's no fun. I got to tell you that.
Yeah, you should move.
Day after tomorrow, it'll be 50.
Wow. I wonder if so many people are getting sick.
Exactly. And it throws you off. You know, you get it. You just automatically put on your long underwear and 3 pairs of socks and extra shirts, and you go out. And by noontime, you know, you need to go home and change again. You know, it's the unexpected, and that's one of the things that makes the situation dangerous, because we take for granted what we think we know about every day. We know that in the summer certain things are going to happen, but when they don't happen anymore, if you're a farmer and your rain comes at the wrong time, forget the amount. You know, drought's a big problem in this country now, not just in California. But, you know, if you don't get the rain at the right time, or if you get that heat wave at the wrong time, you either can't get into your field to plant, or your corn, the pollination doesn't work right, or your cattle all fall over from heat stroke, because even walking down into the watering pond doesn't cool them off enough. Just not knowing what to expect is a big problem, aside from the extreme temperatures and the extreme precipitation or extreme lack of precipitation. And we're just seeing the leading edge of it. And it's a darn good thing that there's something we can do about this, because otherwise it'd be kind of depressing.
Yeah, I'm absolutely there with you because I'm looking into my, you know, I've got children 11, 7, and 5, and I'm going, you know, what kind of a world am I leaving to them when they're my age? So let me leave us with something positive. Leave us with something we can be doing to help change this.
Oh, there's a lot we can do. And I don't mean just changing your light bulbs to more efficient or insulating your house so you don't use so much energy. And all of that is good to do. We need all the help we can get. But the changes that must happen for any of this other, any of these other measures to matter is step one is stop burning fossil fuels like coal, oil, natural gas to make electricity. That accounts for about 40% of the greenhouse gas pollution in the country. Switch over to the clean, green, wind, solar, and as you pointed out, conservation especially. Call on the people to help the utilities manage this transition. They will respond. And then as you're getting the generation side greener and cleaner, switch your vehicle fleet, which is the second single biggest polluter for greenhouse gases. Switch that over to electric. And you don't have to wait. Do it one and then two. Do it all at the same time because even today, you're a little bit better off running an electric car powered by coal-fired power because it's more efficient to make it in advance. But when you're running an electric vehicle with that wonderful torque from those motors, from clean, renewable energy, then you've got a double win. And if we move fast, we can prevent the very, very worst consequences of global warming, and we can preserve the planet to be similar to the one we grew up on. And we want to do that because it's happening so fast, there is no doubt in my mind that one day soon I will need to look my grandchildren in the eye and answer the question I know they'll ask, which is, what were you thinking? Why didn't you stop this? This used to be a wonderful valley of green around the river. And I will be able to look them in the eye and say, I did every damn thing I could do. I love you, and we're still working on it. Not everybody can say that.
I'm with you. I want to be able to do with look to my kids as I look back to my grandparents and my parents' generation that cleaned up Lake Erie when I was a kid. When I was a kid, you couldn't go anywhere near Lake Erie. The entire thing was dead. Uh-huh. The only fish you saw were floating sideways. And that is not, now they've cleaned it up. They've stopped polluting it, so it can be done. John Atkinson, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much. I look forward to having you come back and talk to us again.
Thanks, Rick. Be pleased to do so. Have a good
one. All right, John. Thanks so much, John Atkinson, Energy Policy Director for the Nebraska Wildlife Federation, NebraskaWildlife.org, the website. Quick break. Back with your thoughts right after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Ted Nugent, the old rocker from the 70s, is now just plain old, an office rocker. A political novelty act for the far right and a front man for the National Rifle Association, Nugent regularly spews venomous, vulgar, race-laced, abusive hate speech about liberals, Democrats, gun laws, and creeping communism. In January, for example, he tongue-lashed President Obama, calling him a, quote, communist-raised, communist-educated, communist-nurtured, subhuman mongrel. So, naturally, this scurrilous lout was promptly invited to come to Texas by the leading Republican candidate for governor. It seems that Greg Abbott, currently the state attorney general and a dyed-in-the-wool Tea Party extremist, thought it would juice up his far-out GOP flock to have the rabidly nutty Nugent come campaign with him. Ted came, even embracing the gubernatorial wannabe as his, quote, blood brother. But the brotherhood gambit backfired. Even Republican leaders wondered aloud why Abbott would, as one put it, keep company with a noted misogynist and bigot. In addition to Nugent's disgusting subhuman mongrel slur, the old rocker is also well known for being a sexual predator of underage girls. The issue, however, is not Nugent's sordid character, but Abbott's. hugging an infamous predator and hate monger for political gain is both morally repugnant and politically stupid. Yet, Abbott continues to cling to Nugent's embrace, tersely and cluelessly saying, it's time to move beyond this. A campaign aide even tried to paint Nugent's endorsement as a positive. We appreciate the support of everyone who supports protecting our Constitution. This is Jim Hightower saying, everyone? Sexual predators? Overt racists? Mass murderers? Shouldn't a candidate for governor, even in Texas, draw a sharper moral line than he loves the Second Amendment?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all.
If it's class warfare, my class is winning, but they shouldn't be.
A working class hero is something to be.
The taxation system has tilted toward the rich and away from the middle class.
A working class hero is something to be.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So today, back in 1931, the Davis-Bacon Act officially took hold. It ordered contractors on federally financed or assisted construction projects to pay equal wages equal to those prevailing in the local construction trades. The idea, understand. And you love to hear the right wing of the country going, oh, how could especially here in the center of the state. I get this all the time. Well, why should we have to pay Philadelphia construction rates? I'm going, where'd you get that from? Well, that's what the people over there told us. Well, the people over there are wrong. The idea of a prevailing wage makes complete and total sense, not just to me, but to most economists. The idea that you don't have the floor falling out of your wage structure for a certain craft makes a lot of sense. And for me, the idea that you have a local building trades makes even more sense. Do you really want transient workforces coming from? And I don't care where they're from. Do you want people building stuff in your community that aren't part of your community? Now, I have to ask the question, you know, do you want the guy who's putting the roof on the school that your kid sits in, do you want that person to be from the neighborhood, or do you want somebody who just left? Maybe that person's got a kid sitting in the classroom next to yours. Think maybe they'll take a little extra care? You know, it's one of those things that makes me just baffled. This idea that we're going to deny decent wages from people who work for a living. And look, it is how the wealth class was created. You've seen a massive redistribution of wealth from workers to the folks who the hardest day of work they do is moving, shifting money from one pocket to the other. And this prevailing wage, this is one of those things that the right in this state and in the country has staked their entire party on, stealing wages from people. And what they've done masterfully, and you got to give them credit, what they've done masterfully is they've divorced workers from each other. I mean, they've gone even further. They've divorced citizens from their government. They've tried to divorce members from their unions and workers from each other. To where now we're looking at each other going, well, we're struggling in my household, but they seem to do all right, so let's make them struggle. It's mind-blowing to me. Absolutely mind-blowing. And you've got those on the right, like Ron Miller, the chairman of the Labor and Industry Committee, who said, well, you know, it's racist. You know, they wanted to keep those construction jobs local. We live in a global economy now, he says. So is he advocating that we should get construction workers from China, construction workers from third world countries? Oh, yeah, we did in California. We got welders. Because that's the future, folks. Which is why laws like this, extraordinarily important in my view. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
To be wildcats striking. You know they're going to push us around. Mr. Heffendig and Mr. Hardigan hauling. Because I'm going to leave it in the ground.
Mr. Taft can dig and Mr. Harley can haul, and Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. It's gonna take a lot of long and an 80 short day for this miner to cool on down. Miss Cap can dig it, Mr. Harley can haul it, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. During the February 14th edition of Fox & Friends, co-host Clayton Morris joined his Fox News colleagues in mocking Facebook's decision to offer its users a variety of new gender terms, triggering a wave of criticism, including an open letter from the intersex group Interact, which expressed the group's frustration with feeling, quote, disregarded as a butt of a joke. This past week on Fox & Friends Saturday, Morris took an opportunity to make an impassioned plea for understanding of transgender and intersex people.
I mean, there are a number, I mean, millions of Americans and children who are born with the sexual organs who are not there or are not fully developed and therefore don't define themselves by a particular gender. I mean, that's a fact. It's not as black and white as we would like to make it. Look, I made a pretty ignorant statement a few weeks ago. We were talking about the Facebook story where they added a bunch of different gender identifying things.
Yeah.
And I made sort of an offhanded comment and I regretted it later because, wait a second, there are people who are actually dealing with this and I'm an idiot for saying something stupid like that. So before you open your mouth, just think about it a little bit.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
Southern tomato growers had a pretty good gig going in the early 1800s, selling their produce to northern states. The northern states offered a great market for all the tomatoes grown in the South, but the Civil War provided a difficult interruption. During the war, the North had to import tomatoes from elsewhere, and they did quite well, importing primarily from Bermuda and the Bahamas. When the war between the states ended, southern tomato growers desperately wanted their U.S. market back. So they lobbied Congress in Washington to put a tariff on imported vegetables, which would make their U.S. tomatoes cheaper. And they succeeded. The Tariff Act of 1883 imposed a tax on imported vegetables, but specifically exempted fruits, green, ripe, or dried. The tomato growers were pleased, and of course, the importers were not happy. Join us again for the case of Nix versus Heaven. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
To the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So here in just, I guess, like 2 weeks from tomorrow, it's going to 2 weeks from tomorrow, special election in the 28th senatorial district as one of the guys is, you know, taking a gig to go be the head of the, the Farm Show Complex. Which I'm going, really? I guess that must pay better than being a senator. But he's, I guess, bailing out. So here now they're going to have this special election where a number of Republicans have lined up and there's special funky backroom dealings and a lot of, this could be a reality show to be honest. But I've got one of the candidates, the Democrat, Linda Small, who is running, really, I got to give her credit. An uphill battle, in my view, but hopefully we will see positive results. Linda, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thanks for having me, Rick.
So good on you. I mean, we see a lot of these elections that all these backroom dealings and the big money comes in, and you know people kind of shy away. I give you the ultimate credit for stepping forward and saying, you know, I'm taking them on.
Well, I appreciate that, and this time I've got some people stepping forward with me, helping me out. And I'm hoping we can make the Republicans pay. It's going to take a lot of voters who don't usually come out for special elections to come out. But if we want to take a stand, now's the time to take the stand.
So explain this to me, because I understand the guy who was the sitting senator, Mike Waugh, I think his name was.
Mm-hmm.
He took a gig as the head of the Farm Show Complex.
Well, that's one of the interesting things about politics. As you know, if you're over 50, most people don't get jobs thrown at them. He got a very good job thrown at him. So he took it. He had said he was going to serve to the end of this term and then not run for re-election. But that changed, and that's where the backroom dealings started, where Republican leadership took a look at the situation, and maybe they didn't like having a special election on May 20th when a lot of Democrats would be coming out to the primary. Whatever their reasoning, you know, what they say it is, they decided that 9 weeks from when the senator stepped down that we would have a special election. And that's triggered a whole lot of discussion and anger within the Republican Party. Certainly from our perspective, it's a $200,000, give or take, waste of taxpayer money. In my perspective, it's even worse because this was designed partially to disenfranchise people because, as you know, most people don't know about these things, so therefore they wouldn't come to vote for their new state senator.
Yeah.
And I think it's a huge shame because after you've been in power, I think you noted in the program, the Republicans control the House, the Senate, the governorship, and I even mentioned the courts, even though they're not part of the political process. You should be talking issues. You should be running on what you've done to help create jobs and to fund education, and how are things going with holding the line on taxes? And in my district, they're not going real well. We're seeing a lot of school districts have to raise taxes, the county raise taxes. So instead of discussing that, we have this sideshow going on. Like I said, I hope we can take advantage of it and have enough of our voters come out to hold them accountable. And that's what we're trying to do.
And I look at this, and again, you know, the guy who was handpicked, this Ron Miller, who is, as I understand, the chairman of the Labor Committee, who I talked about in the last segment, you know, this idea that he wanted to bring up prevailing wage is some racist thing, and then now we live in this global economy. One of the questions I've always wanted to ask him was, you know, is he advocating by saying that we live in this global economy and don't need prevailing wage, is he advocating for bringing Chinese workers to build our roads and bridges and our schools and our hospitals and all the things in our Commonwealth? I've always wanted to ask him that question. I never get the chance.
No, you'll have to come down. There's going to be a forum where you know, he and I will give him credit. He comes to the candidate forums. But, you know, I've said it before. He sincerely believes that what he's doing creates a good business climate. And one of the points that I'm running to make is that, no, having good, strong unions with fair wages, that creates a good business climate.
Yeah.
You look at history, I'm a history major, coming out of World War II, the greatest generation that lived through the Depression, they created Social Security, they fought World War II, they came out of it. One of the things they had was strong unions, and we had one of the strongest economies we ever had when we had the strong unions, the fair wages. We didn't have this massive inequality. And that's what we need to get back to. We know it works. We just need to get back to it.
So I understand, again, March 18th is the day. How much advertising, how much push? Because I got to wonder, you know, in a general off-year election, you usually get about 13% of the voting population to come out. I can't imagine how low the turnout will be. Since I don't think most people are going to know that the election's going on. How much advertising has been going on to push this?
Well, that's the interesting wild card. There is a Tea Party type candidate who has a lot of funds, some of it his own and some of it raised from other people. So he is running a write-in campaign, and he has used his money to kind of get the word out on the special election, which in a way it does help me because it helps get over the hurdle of, hey, there's a special election. So we have that, and of course the Republican candidate who's on the ballot, he's sending out information now because I think there's enough worry and that if he doesn't spend money now that he may be defeated. So there's that. And then, of course, part of this whole complication is we are all having to petition to get on the ballot for the primary. So as part of that petitioning process, the people that are going out on my behalf, and I have to give them a shout out because, boy, the weather's been brutal.
Yeah.
You got to appreciate those are the unsung heroes. But
absolutely.
We have rap cards that they can also hand out and, you know, put indoors and say, hey, there's a special election. So at least we've been able to leverage a positive out of some of this negativity surrounding the situation.
Yeah, I give people credit for going out and getting signatures now. I don't know what genius thought up. It would be a great time that in February you go running around collecting, in February and March collecting signatures. Maybe we should be rethinking that one. So Linda Small, a Democratic candidate for the 28th Senatorial District, her website, smallforpasenate.com. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com, facebook.com/smallforpa. Senate, also Twitter handle at small, the number 4, PA Senate. We've got links at thericksmithshow.com. So let's talk about the issues now, because I think it's important that there's a clear distinction. I look at someone like Miller, who candidly against a prevailing wage, against paying decent wages for workers. I know minimum wage is going to be coming up. I can absolutely declare that he will be against that. Where are you on both those issues?
Well, certainly I think prevailing wage is kind of part of this whole package of treating workers fairly. It's a part and parcel of the same thought process of living wage. Representative Miller surprised me the other day. He's not against raising the minimum wage. He's just not sure it needs to go up to, you know, 10-10 or, you know, he wants to lowball. But I will give him credit. He did say he was for raising the minimum wage, which should tell us where we are in the political spectrum. But we differ. One of the reasons I think that he has not gotten results, the Republicans have not gotten results, is while they say that they want to have a free market, they have gotten this corporate welfare thing out of control. I mentioned last time I was on the show the $30 million state grant to Comcast to build a skyscraper in Philadelphia.
Right.
When you do that, you have to either cut programs or raise taxes at the local level, because you say you don't have enough money to fund education. Well, you don't, because you're giving these tax breaks. As I've been researching, I've found that since 2002, we've been just increasing tax breaks year after year after year for these well-connected corporations, and that's why we can't make the budget balance, and that's why we keep telling people that we don't have enough money to fund education. That's why we cut 20,000 teachers. Speaking of jobs, you know, those are 20,000 good jobs cut right there. So that's one of the areas that I differ in. You can't, and I think your guest Rob McCord might have mentioned some of this, you can't keep doing some of this stuff and look at the results and say, you know, yeah, we need to keep doing more. We need to cut back there. So, and then for minimum wage, I think that is definitely, we have to raise that. And I was intrigued by Rob McCord's 1070 argument. I thought 1010 was, you know, the place to start and then move it up. But certainly, you know, the inflation-adjusted thing is important. I think education funding is just critical. That's an investment. And Ron Miller went along, and I think even on his web page when he was running, said, you know, we cut $1 billion from the state budget. He didn't say, well, that's that $1 billion from education that we cut. And then, of course, local taxes. Some areas of the state don't have this problem, but our local taxes on both the county and the most of the school districts have gone up, and it's for that same reason. You can't keep giving tax breaks to corporations and expect local taxpayers to make up the difference. The property taxes here are unfair, unsustainable, and we can fix it if you have different priorities.
And that's the important thing, the priorities. Because, you know, when the Republicans took over, and I know Wall was there before, but when the Republicans really took major power in 2010 with the governor's mansion and larger increases in the House, they said they were going to focus on jobs, jobs, jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Yet all I've seen is division, divisiveness, and destruction of jobs, and also giving away of our treasury. And you bring up a point I talk about often. All of this money that we're giving away in special tax breaks and sweeteners for deals that were probably going to happen anyway. I look at the $1.7 billion they're going to give the Royal Dutch Shell over the next quarter century to build a plant they were probably going to build in that exact location anyway, all at the expense of my kids.
Right, and it's multi-pronged, because you're digging a hole each year. So, you know, it's almost like you're losing two things. It's you're losing that income, but you've also dug the hole, which means you've cut the services, you've cut the jobs. The transportation bill is a good example. They delayed that. They knew they needed a transportation bill. Instead of compromising, you know, and getting it done, they didn't. Well, for every $1 billion in transportation spending, it costs, it supports about 30,000 jobs is what the math works out to. So they didn't create about 60,000-90,000 jobs each year, and that's more tax revenue. So it's a vicious circle because they will not step back and say, what is the result? You know, we believe something, but what is the result? You can say the same thing for Medicare, and I know that my opponent doesn't want to see this Medicare expansion under the Affordable Care Act. That's both the 40,000 jobs that studies show will be created. And one of the points that I want to make that really differentiates me from my opponents is they treat it kind of as an accounting problem. They don't see that there are real people behind this accounting problem. They don't have respect, I think, for a lot of the people who need help, the unemployed who might need some unemployment, and they don't even really see people sometimes, and I think that's just got to change. We need Harrisburg public servants to actually respect the people that they serve.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, one of the things that I think is important, and boy, I think you really hit on that with the Medicaid expansion. Now, you spent, you know, 27 years in the military where I say they had, you know, they have universal health care. Was it a horrible thing that everybody in your ranks, that the person next to you and on both sides of you, that they had health care? Was that a horrible thing?
As you know, it made the things better because you didn't have somebody who couldn't do their job because they were in pain. You could go get them some help. They weren't making everybody else sick. And in the business world, it's the same thing. There have been studies done when you have areas like Washington, D.C. or San Francisco implement sick leave policies, you save money. They know that when workers go to work sick, it costs business money. And I don't think I could cite the study, but it's billions of dollars that are cost because workers come to work sick, they can't do the job, they make others sick. You know, it's once again, it's what are the results? What are the results of your policies? And then one more thing I just want to quickly make sure I get in is I was a meteorologist, a weather forecaster when I was in the Navy. So this global warming discussion that you had just before I was on was very interesting, and I agree completely with all the points you made. Both my opponents in this election just do not have any understanding of the reality of global warming. And if you think we're having problems now and economic costs, they're just going to get much, much worse. The Dust Bowl, the permanent Dust Bowl that I think it was John mentioned, that's by 2050, but since we're putting out more greenhouse gases than the study mentioned, it may well come earlier. For Pennsylvania, a lot of our crops by the middle to the end of the century, they're going to have their heat stress threshold exceeded with both nighttime temperatures and, you know, daytime temperatures just soaring above 90 and 100 all the time. It's just going to be ugly, and we can switch the switch to renewable energy and more efficient electricity for cars creates jobs. And locally, there's a couple companies that have had to lay off workers. They were involved in the solar industry, and that just doesn't seem to register on the other side. But that's critical. Like I said, you got kids. I got a niece and nephew and a grandnephew now. We have got to be working on a lot of things real quick.
So are you going to be that person that's one of the key things you bring? Because, look, I look at what Governor Corbett and the Republicans have done to the solar renewable energy credits, the SRECs, which when I put solar panels on my house, the SRECs were going for about $225. They're down in the $10 to $15 range right now. And that the solar industry is basically, in Pennsylvania, dead. People who are doing solar are doing it in Maryland or New Jersey or somewhere else. They're not doing it here anymore because the payoff is, it takes too long to get to. And again, to me, it's bad priorities. It's bad policy.
I will be. I have solar panels on my house, so I've stopped selling SRECs, so if I'm elected, that I won't have a conflict of interest. Plus, you don't get any money for it. But that's what I will bring, is the awareness of, A, there's a problem, and, B, there are solutions. And the solutions are actually exciting, because once you put in solar and wind, you only have to maintain the systems. You're not paying to go back, extract the energy from the ground, refine it, burn it, and then you don't have to go back again. So it lowers costs. Solar and wind are competitive in some of our markets right now, and they will be competitive very soon. I think that it's critical, because it just ties into everything else. Who's going to care, you know, if we have problems producing food and food prices go up out of the, you know, out the roof, that's going to just blow away some of the other priorities we care about.
Yep.
And it's morally, economically the right thing to do. And we've got the technology now. We have smartphones, we have smart young people, we have smart technology, American know-how. We can do this. It's just the fossil fuel companies have got to leave some of that fuel in the ground for a long period of time. But we can still have employment in their industry, because they poked holes in the ground. You have to keep them sealed. You know, and we will need some gas for things like plastics, things like that. But we have to make that transition right away. And this is where I'll even push Democrats. If natural gas is a bridge fuel, and yes, we should have a severance tax on it right now, a robust severance tax, tell me when we get off the bridge. Show me the numbers that say we get off the bridge in time. We need to be pushing away from that. We need to have a plan. And that's what I bring.
I'm thinking about moving to your neighborhood now.
Thank you.
Probably wouldn't be able to vote in the March 18th election, and I'm hoping that people do come out and vote March 18th. Regardless, I'm a big proponent of people exercising their right to the franchise and casting their ballot without a photo ID and without the fingerprint checks and the retinal scans that I know are coming.
Yes.
People exercising their right. Last line of questioning I've got for you now. The composition of the Senate, one more seat to kind of balance the power seems to me could be an extraordinarily positive thing in getting some of the really crazy stuff off the plate, off of Corbett's agenda, and really start looking at doing things that are bipartisan, are nonpartisan, and get us moving in the right direction. So do you think that, do you see that as part of your role as well?
Very much so. One of the reasons to run an uphill battle is to get a voice that says, here are some solutions. And one of the reasons to get elected is to implement solutions. I will never say that any Republican out there is evil or trying to do things that harm people. But if I can be a new voice and start helping to push towards the solutions, that's going to help. And yes, it does kind of tip it, because not all Republicans in the Senate come from the same place. Geographically, there are some differences in philosophy. If I can make the argument someday, as I pray I will be able to, that, global warming is a problem, that we need to pay attention to it because we've ignored it too long, and there are solutions that help the economy, clean up the air, it's win-win-win, then we'll have done something. So that's why I ask people to come out and vote, because this could be a real game changer.
I'm right there with you. Again, the election is on March 18th. That's only a couple of days away, so put it on the calendar, write it on your hand, whatever you've got to do to make sure you remember March 18th. If you're in the 28th senatorial district, that you get out and vote and cast that ballot if I were living there, I would be voting for Linda Small, unquestioning. Linda, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Again, the website, Small, the number 4, PASenate.com. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Linda Small's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith. Smith Show.
Ted Nugent, the old rocker from the 70s, is now just plain old, an office rocker. A political novelty act for the far right and a front man for the National Rifle Association, Nugent regularly spews venomous, vulgar, race-laced, abusive hate speech about liberals, Democrats, gun laws, and creeping communism. In January, for example, he tongue-lashed President Obama, calling him a, quote, communist-raised, communist-educated, communist-nurtured, subhuman mongrel. So, naturally, this scurrilous lout was promptly invited to come to Texas by the leading Republican candidate for governor. It seems that Greg Abbott, currently the state attorney general and a dyed-in-the-wool Tea Party extremist, thought it would juice up his far-out GOP flock to have the rabidly nutty Nugent come campaign with him. Ted came, even embracing the gubernatorial wannabe as his, quote, blood brother. But the brotherhood gambit backfired. Even Republican leaders wondered aloud why Abbott would, as one put it, keep company with a noted misogynist and bigot. In addition to Nugent's disgusting subhuman mongrel slur, the old rocker is also well known for being a sexual predator of underage girls. The issue, however, is not Nugent's sordid character, but Abbott's. Hugging an infamous predator and hate monger for political gain is both morally repugnant and politically stupid. Yet, Abbott continues to cling to Nugent's embrace, tersely and cluelessly saying, it's time to move beyond this. A campaign aide even tried to paint Nugent's endorsement as a positive. We appreciate the support of everyone who supports protecting our Constitution. This is Jim Hightower saying, everyone? Sexual predators? Overt racists? Mass murderers? Shouldn't a candidate for governor, even in Texas, draw a sharper moral line than he loves the Second Amendment?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
You know, I gotta tell you, March, it blows my mind, the people who talk about fiscal responsibility, they care about their good stewards of the dollar, that they would say, hey, let's have a special election 2 months before, we're having a primary. It just seems, it seems dumb to me. But again, what it is, it's the backroom dealing, it's the, hey, we're gonna game the system. That's what it is, more than anything and whatsoever. And if you live in the 28th senatorial district, that's, I guess, York, the city of York, some of the other areas around that surrounding area, that's the district. If that's your district, get out and vote. Get out and cast that ballot, because, it's these elections that are so important. And I look at this seat in the 28th senatorial district. If this were to go to Linda Small and to a Democrat, what that could mean for sanity, what that could mean for just balancing things out and making sure that, some rational thought takes over and maybe some of the really real ugliness, maybe some of that stops. Let's take a quick break. Right back with Hour 3. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The United Auto Workers is urging the NLRB to apply something called the Westwood Test to the union's challenge of the Chattanooga, Tennessee VW union election results. The five-factor test has been used in past cases to decide whether results were tainted. The UAW says anti-union Tennessee politicians and right-wing groups interfered so much in that election that it created, quote, a general atmosphere of fear of reprisal rendering a free election impossible, end quote. A right-wing anti-union group is fighting the UAW-NLRB appeal of the election results. The Westwood test arose from a unionization drive at Westwood Horizons Hotel in Los Angeles during the 1980s. In that case, some workers threatened and harassed other workers to pressure them to vote for the union. Workers voted for a union, but the hotel challenged the results, and the NLRB ordered a new election. To meet the Westwood test, the NLRB would have to decide that threats made at the VW plant would affect all voting workers, were widely made, that those making the threats had the power to carry them out, and whether workers acted or voted in fear of the threats, and whether the threats coincided with the election. The UAW has until March 7th to finish making its case, and the NLRB will then decide whether to proceed with the case. Kentucky Republicans have launched an effort to pass so-called right-to-work anti-union legislation in Kentucky. Democrats control the Kentucky House, so passage is unlikely. Kentucky AFL-CIO President Bill Londrigan.
It hurts our financial ability to represent our workers. The whole goal of this thing is to undermine our ability to effectively represent our members. They claim that we are forcing people to be in a union. That is a complete mistruth. We cannot force anybody to be a member of a union. It's against the law. The Supreme Court decided that back in 1963.
U.S. Airways flight attendants have ratified an agreement on bargaining between the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, and the Association of Professional Flight Attendants at American Airlines. It establishes joint bargaining for a single labor contract for flight attendants at American, the world's largest airline. That strengthens solidarity and bargaining leverage for all 24,000 flight attendants at American Airlines. The two unions this week will begin forming a joint bargaining team for an opening proposal to the company, combining the best of both union contracts. On Wednesday, Kentucky civil rights, labor, faith, and other activist groups will commemorate the 50th anniversary of the state's largest civil rights march in Frankfort. The march was led by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. King was pro-union, and he said the labor movement was the principal force that transformed misery and despair into hope and progress. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So today, the big rally that I was going to go to out in Pittsburgh, but the snow, I was expecting a foot. They were saying a foot of snow. I think I got maybe an eighth of an inch on the car. Maybe there was a little dusting. There was something. I know the kids were all excited that they got a two-hour delay. And threat of snow, because they said, you know, maybe a little bit later on in the day. But that didn't stop the folks out in Pittsburgh, who I understand it was brutally cold. Hundreds of people in the streets to say to UPMC, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, we demand a living wage. And one of the folks who was out in the cold, braving the bitter cold in Pittsburgh, is Sue DeLosier. She is a registered nurse out there. Sue, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
As I said, bitter cold. From the pictures that I saw, I'm going, wow, the dedication, the devotion. I don't know that you're going to get many CEOs and many corporate executives to brave that kind of weather to demand some respect there.
No, I doubt that there were any CEOs out here on the line with us, that's for sure.
But, you know, I look at this, and this, we're seeing all across the country low-wage workers saying, you know what, our work is important, what we do is important, and we should be respected with at least a wage that helps us support our families and benefits that when we get sick, that we can go to the place that we take care of others and be taken care of.
Correct, right. There was a lot of workers here that were speaking that basically have worked here for 9+ years, and they're still making a little $11 an hour, which is terribly. I think it's poverty level, actually.
Yeah, and talking to some of those folks, as I have over the past couple of months, you know, the fact that we've propped up a low-wage economy because, you know, the state comes in a lot of cases and gives Medicaid where it's needed. Their food stamps when that's needed, and other things, LIHEAP, and many other programs that, you know, people don't want handouts. They want to be able to make their own way, and the wages that they earn should be able to cover those. And I think that's one of the main sentiments that I kept seeing as I saw my Twitter feed light up with comments, and I saw all the information coming across the line.
Oh, absolutely. Most of the speakers here that are UPMC workers have worked here, and they just want to be able to take care of themselves. They want to have to just have one job that they can go to, spend some time with their families, and they're ending up either taking extra jobs or even if they take the extra job, it's a minimum wage job, so it doesn't really give them anything. And a lot of them have a lot of bills that they have accrued that they can't even pay them all at one time. They have to pay one bill a month. Several people have said that during the rally today, several of the speakers. And it is just, it's terrible, especially when you have a company as huge as UPMC, a billion-dollar company that has all these profits. And there's no reason that they shouldn't have a living wage.
But I kept hearing the phrase and sentiments coming back to me through email and through Twitter that, well, it's a free market. Come on, Sue, it's a free market. If you don't like what you're getting paid, you could go to the hospital across the street and go work for them for better wages.
Well, the hospital across the street happens to be a UPMC hospital, so where are you going to go? They're all the same hospital connected together, and, you know, what do you do?
But what about competition in the free market? There has to be another hospital, right?
The only other hospital I believe here, I'm not from here, I'm from Altoona.
Okay.
But, I mean, I know there's the...
there were three of them when I Googled...
Allegheny General.
There were three of them when I Googled Pittsburgh hospitals. There were three of them that were all owned by UPMC, which is why I asked the question. Because we keep hearing this, well, there's competition. Not really. This is the behemoth.
No, there isn't.
This is almost a monopoly.
Oh, it's definitely a monopoly. And, you know, when... that they don't really care. They say you can go work at one of their other hospitals, but you still get paid the same. It doesn't really matter. And they don't give them the cost of living or wages that cover the cost of living. And it's just really sad. I can't imagine working and living under those conditions.
So if you've got this $10 billion behemoth, and this just isn't in Pittsburgh, it's across the state and into Ohio and a number of other places that this company has grown into and, well, monopolized into a lot of areas. You got this $10 billion behemoth setting the conditions for everything. There's not much room for competition and very little room for dissension. So I look at what's going on, and I got to be honest, I give the hundreds of workers that braved the bitter cold today the utmost credit for being willing to stand up and have their voices heard against this huge company.
Yes, they're very brave for doing all this, and but I think that they're at the point that what else can they do? They have to do this. They have to stand up for themselves, and they have to become united.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Sue Delosier. She is a UPMC RN, and I understand you're from the Altoona area. For the past couple of weeks, we've been talking to folks who were on strike for a day, then got locked out for some time. There was a whole bunch of back and forth. At a place, as I understand it, and help me if I'm wrong, that had never really had labor strife until UPMC came in and took over. But I understand now you guys have a contract.
We do have a contract now. After 5 months, we have it, and the strike definitely made a difference.
Now, as I said, this was a place that before this big behemoth came in, you didn't really have these problems, did you?
No, we worked with management. When we initially got our contract, and it was about 7 years ago, and that's when we formed our union. So our union isn't that old, but we had built up a relationship with our managers at Altoona Regional, and we gave a lot across the table from each other. We may not have agreed with each other totally, but we worked together, and we were working things out. So, yes, this was the first time that we really didn't see that cooperation since UPMC took over. So
what we could take from that instance that UPMC taking over into a place where you really never had those kind of problems before is, as they go into other areas, I guess you could surmise that that's what's in the future for other places, because this is an entity, and a nonprofit entity at that, that's supposed to be a charity, which I find kind of ironic. That will
you and me both.
that will impose their will as opposed to working together in a cooperative fashion. That's what I find kind of interesting, especially from the charitable nonprofit angle.
Well, and I think that they're trying to get that nonprofit status here in Pittsburgh, you know, knocked down because they haven't proved themselves a nonprofit by their actions.
Do you think that's their goal, to get away with that so they don't have to be saddled with that and they can just take as much as they want then? Because now they've grown to such a level that they're the monster in the room.
There's definitely a monster in the room. Like, we went through it when we went through our contract negotiations and we went out on the line, the one girl had, they're the Goliath, but we're the David, you know, and that's exactly how we had to approach it. You know, you just have to do what you have to do. And when you show such unity, which the nurses did, I think that was phenomenal. And I think that showed them that when you do things together, you can accomplish a lot.
And do you think that victory had some, as you were in Pittsburgh today, being one of the folks from Altoona, do you think that gave the folks in Pittsburgh some hope that maybe this fight that they're waging, there's light at the end of the tunnel, there's opportunity there?
Oh, I absolutely think, you know, that if they are all unified, all of their hospitals together, I think that will do a lot. That will show their power. Oh, absolutely, I believe that. And they're not asking for a whole lot. They just want to be able to have a living wage. And a lot of them, too, their insurances aren't covering what they're going to the hospital for, and they have monstrous bills that they have to pay, and they just want, you know, you're a hospital that has an insurance company. Why are their employees having such outrageous bills? I just don't understand that.
And that's something I don't think a lot of people understand or know, that they actually have their own insurance, they're self-insured, and they have their own hospital. Why is it their employees don't have that access to the care that they're giving to others? It really makes absolutely no sense to me, really on any level, when you look at it, that you're providing care for society, yet the people who are the ones providing that care don't get it. It makes no sense to me.
Well, and a lot of their employees, with what they were saying, that they won't go to the hospital because they can't afford to go, because they have such, you know, high deductibles and copays that they can't afford to do it because they're not even making a decent wage, so they have to use all their money just to survive. And unfortunately, you know, you can only do that so long. If you have a horrible disease or anything that's going wrong with you, you have to go to the hospital at some point, you know, so it's kind of a no-win situation for them.
And when you have to go to a hospital and there's only one company that's really doing it, even though there may be different hospitals all owned by the same entity, which, again, back to, you know, I believe I'm with the conservatives on the idea of competition. I'm with you. We should have people competing.
Competition is definitely good. Mm-hmm. Competition is good.
I'm with them on that. But mm-hmm. yet I don't see how having these monopolies is good for patients. I don't see how it's good for our cities and our states. And I certainly don't believe it's good for workers.
Oh, no, not at all.
Because, you know, I go back to, you know, I got a number of these people saying, well, you know, I work for UPMC and I make a fair wage and I'm far from poverty. And these are folks who don't actually deal with patients. So the people who deal with patients, I guess in their world, they don't deserve to not live in poverty. But the folks who are the corporate flacks, who are the PR people, who are the marketing people, they do just fine. Thank you very much.
Yes, I'm sure they do. And we're talking about the people that do the work to keep the hospital running, the maintenance, cafeteria workers, whoever, you know, that are there. And they've been there for several years and they still haven't, you know, given them any kind of wage increase. And let's face it, you know, the cost of living goes up every year. It doesn't matter if they don't give you a raise, it still goes up. So if you were making $11 an hour 3 years ago and you're still making $11 3 years ago, you're way behind the eight ball.
Now, when you've got a CEO who's making millions of dollars, and you got the number I saw thrown around today, the top 28 executives took somewhere near $50 million in compensation. It could be somewhere in that ballpark. And you've got folks who are who never come near a patient, mind you. I would find it difficult to believe that the CEO Romanoff guy is out there actually taking people's temperatures and wiping behinds and doing all that other stuff. I find that incredibly difficult to believe. But he'll take multiples of millions of dollars while the person actually doing the work and actually making the profit for the company, they're having to go with their hands out for healthcare somewhere else. It's mind blowing.
It is mind-blowing, Chris. You know, and again, it's just they're asking for fair compensation. They're asking for the right to unionize without being targeted without being fired, you know, just so they can negotiate something that is livable. When, if you would treat your employees well, you wouldn't need to do this. If you treated them well, gave them a good wage, you have an insurance, at least you don't have to give it to them, but, you know, at least give them something that they can use that is comparable to what they make. You know, you can't charge them outrageous sums of money and then expect them to pay all these bills and be able to support themselves.
Yeah, well, I don't think they really care about that. I would argue the contract that the CEO got, and the CEO has a contract. I would probably assume that the workers asking for a contract, the numbers are in completely different stratospheres.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Well, I would assume the contract the CEO of the company has much higher wages than the workers are asking for right now. They're completely different arenas,
yeah.
Different stratospheres,
right.
Different universes. That simple.
Right.
So let me ask you, after today's event, what do you see going forward? This was a huge success in my view, especially on a bitterly cold day like today. Where does this go from here?
I guess the next step is the employees will be able to sign cards and be able to take a vote in order to get to a union vote to see if they want unionization, and then go from there and then be able to work on a contract.
And I would assume that now, unlike Volkswagen, I don't foresee UPMC taking a pledge of neutrality.
No, I doubt seriously they will.
Unless neutrality
is take some pointers from the German company.
I'm right there with you. Maybe put some of those workers on their board. Maybe take a look at their CEO's salary and go, hey, that's too much.
Yeah.
We'll share a little bit of that. Sue, I appreciate the time. Good on you for being out in the bitter cold there in Pittsburgh, and congratulations on the contract. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Ted Nugent, the old rocker from the 70s, is now just plain old, an office rocker. A political novelty act for the far right and a front man for the National Rifle Association, Nugent regularly spews venomous, vulgar, race-laced, abusive hate speech about liberals, Democrats, gun laws, and creeping communism. In January, for example, he tongue-lashed President Obama, calling him a, quote, communist-raised, communist-educated, communist-nurtured, subhuman mongrel. So, naturally, this scurrilous lout was promptly invited to come to Texas by the leading Republican candidate for governor. It seems that Greg Abbott, currently the state attorney general and a dyed-in-the-wool Tea Party extremist, thought it would juice up his far-out GOP flock to have the rabidly nutty Nugent come campaign with him. Ted came, even embracing the gubernatorial wannabe as his, quote, blood brother. But the brotherhood gambit backfired. Even Republican leaders wondered aloud why Abbott would, as one put it, keep company with a noted misogynist and bigot. In addition to Nugent's disgusting subhuman mongrel slur, the old rocker is also well known for being a sexual predator of underage girls. The issue, however, is not Nugent's sordid character, but Abbott's. Hugging an infamous predator and hate monger for political gain is both morally repugnant and politically stupid. Yet, Abbott continues to cling to Nugent's embrace, tersely and cluelessly saying, it's time to move beyond this. A campaign aide even tried to paint Nugent's endorsement as a positive. We appreciate the support of everyone who supports protecting our Constitution. This is Jim Hightower saying, everyone? Sexual predators? Overt racists? Mass murderers? Shouldn't a candidate for governor, even in Texas, draw a sharper moral line than he loves the Second Amendment?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. So, you know, today, back in 1906, the Lumber Workers Union in Humboldt County, California, they formed the Union Labor Hospital Association, which established a hospital for union workers in that county. The hospital went on to become an extremely important community facility financed and run by the workers themselves. And I go back to this idea of community hospitals, of we the people. You know, you love to hear the right-wing argument of, oh, we're talking about competition. There doesn't seem to be any competition when you look at in Pittsburgh. And I Googled it. I said, you know, where are the hospitals? Show me the hospitals in Pittsburgh. And the three that popped up were all UPMC hospitals, all owned by one company, who claim a nonprofit status. And I think, as Sue pointed out, they do want to get rid of that, because now that they have the monopoly, now that they've got control, it's time to cash in. And, you know, I stop and I think about this, and I had gotten into this Twitter back and forth, and I shouldn't feed the trolls. Because I knew from the beginning he was a corporate flack. I knew from the beginning, you know, just having looked up who he was, worked in the marketing department at UPMC, saying, well, I make, you know, fair. And then the wording that he used was classic. I make a fair wage. And then, interestingly enough, he let it out. He doesn't even make a good wage. He claims he makes a fair wage. And I guess you could debate what a good wage is. But he kept going back to this belief that there's this market out there, and it's free, and that somehow there are forces that dictate what his life is worth, what the hours of his life are worth. And you go, well, I get the argument on paper. You know, I learned about, you know, supply and demand and equilibrium and all of that stuff. But that's when you have forces that are competitive, that are equal. You're talking about a monopoly. Come on, where's the competition? There is none. But I just find it incredible that we have allowed ourselves to be pitted against one another. Now, this guy, you know, again, I'm not allowed to know all the information. I'll only get these 140 characters shot at me. And you go, shouldn't you be out there with them making sure that the folks who are creating the product that you're marketing can afford to live and be good stewards and good examples for the community? I mean, really, honestly and truthfully? And one of the things at bay here, and what Sue pointed out, is that just for the right to organize, for the right to recognition of their bargaining unit, the right to sit down at a table and negotiate for better wages, hours, and conditions, that's at play here. And UPMC, this charitable organization, is saying, no, you get none of that. And I find it interesting, with our quote of the day, from this, you know, this really radical, way out, hippie liberal type, long hair hippie liberal type, the Pope, who said trade unions have been an essential force for social change, without which a semblance of a decent and humane society is impossible under capitalism. You know, that hippie liberal way, that extreme liberal, that Marxist, that communist. Because, you know, oddly enough, I was called many of those things for saying workers should have the right to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. The profits that they create, they should share in. Somehow, in the twisted world view of some, that's communism. And, well, it's not the definition that I learned that communism was. But, you know, hey, state ownership of everything, which I am not advocating for, that doesn't play in this. Just asking for better wages, demanding better wages, hours, and conditions, that's enough to be labeled socialist, communist. Frustrating. I'll tell you, just frustrating stuff, man. And, you know, you look at our standing in the world, and we love to puff our chests out and say, we're number one, don't we? Absolutely. What we are is number one in de-unionized society. And the people over at Demos, who I agree very little with, have written an interesting piece on the de-unionization of America and our standing in the world. And they did a nice little infograph that points out the number of workers covered by collective bargaining agreements, the number of workers who are members of labor unions, dues-paying members. And in the world, the United States has the second lowest number of dues-paying union members in the world. We're only behind France when it comes to actual union membership. A lower percentage of the actual workforce members of unions. Now, the difference is they have a much different model. And I've said this a number of times in the past, that in France, you've got like 5% of the workers who are actually members of unions, the actual dues-paying voting members of unions as we would identify them today. Card-carrying, dues-paying members. Yet, those 5% who are supporting that union, the contracts under which that they fight for cover 90% of the workforce. So 90% of the workers in France are covered by labor unions, by their contracts. No, obviously, you know, 95% of those don't pay the union dues, but they do get the benefits. Which I guess, you know, if you really listen to the right-wing arguments, that's what they want the model to be here in the U.S. The difference is France has much stronger labor laws. Much, much stronger. Much stronger pro-worker union, worker-friendly laws. Like a 35-hour work week. And no time and a half nonsense over 35-hour work week. And you've got to make a living on 35 hours. Which means the employers have got to pay a better wage. Here in the U.S., you've got just run around 11.5% of the workforce in this country unionized, which always makes me laugh when people say, big labor, powerful big labor, destroying everything. Talking about a very 11.6%, I think the number was. Now, here in the U.S., 13.3% of workers are covered by contracts. And I just found it really amazing as you look across the globe, where in Austria, for instance, you see about 30% of the workforce who are card-carrying, dues-paying members of unions, while 99% of the workforce are members of the collective bargaining process. They are covered by the contracts, their wages, their hours, their conditions, everything is part of that. You look at Belgium, where Belgium has in excess of 50% union membership that covers about 96% of their workers. And, you know, just go down the list, where in Sweden, over more than 70% of the workforce are union members, covering 91% of the workforce. And you wonder why their standards of living are higher, why they have national health care, why they have strong retirement systems. You kind of got to, you know, be asking those questions. Where no one seems to ever ask the question, why our CEO class, they can have contracts where they know what their employment status and their conditions are going to be. But you and me, we're at will. We come to work tomorrow and the boss says, don't like the shoes, gotta go. You go. I go back to the original National Labor Relations Act, which gives no rights to employers. Not one single right was given to employers in the original National Labor Relations Act. Nothing. Because at the time, they understood, as we should understand still today, the employer holds all the cards. The balance of power is so badly skewed that some rights had to be given to workers. Now, it's never equal. You're never going to be on equal footing. It's never going to happen, and it's never been there. You know, even as powerful as labor was in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, they were never equal. And all most people that I know are asking for is to be seated at the table, not the course on the menu, to be able to have their work rewarded with a decent wage that they can support their families with. I don't think that's too much to ask for. But when you look at these numbers, you look at the rates of unionization across the globe and the standard of living in those countries, and it just makes you stop and go, the Pope's right. The Pope is absolutely right. Without those unions, without the ability to bargain for better wages, hours, conditions, without the ability to fight the corporate power, what would our society look like? Would it be decent? Would it be humane? Because as he said, trade unions have been an essential force for social change, without which a semblance of a decent and humane society is impossible under capitalism. Hooray for me and screw everybody else. Only works for a handful of people. You kind of got to wonder. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. This is another Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
Southern tomato growers had a pretty good gig going in the early 1800s, selling their produce to northern states. The northern states offered a great market for all the tomatoes grown in the South, but the Civil War provided a difficult interruption. During the war, the North had to import tomatoes from elsewhere, and they did quite well, importing primarily from Bermuda and the Bahamas. When the war between the states ended, Southern tomato growers desperately wanted their U.S. market back. So they lobbied Congress in Washington to put a tariff on imported vegetables, which would make their U.S. tomatoes cheaper, and they succeeded. The Tariff Act of 1883 imposed a tax on imported vegetables, but specifically exempted fruits, green, ripe, or dried. The tomato growers were pleased, and of course, the importers were not happy. Join us again for the case of Nix versus Heaven. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. During the February 14th edition of Fox & Friends, co-host Clayton Morris joined his Fox News colleagues in mocking Facebook's decision to offer its users a variety of new gender terms, triggering a wave of criticism, including an open letter from the intersex group Interact, which expressed the group's frustration with feeling, quote, disregarded as a butt of a joke. This past week on Fox & Friends Saturday, Morris took an opportunity to make an impassioned plea for understanding of transgender and intersex people.
I mean, there are millions of Americans and children who are born with the sexual organs who are not there or are not fully developed and therefore don't define themselves by a particular gender. I mean, that's a fact. It's not as black and white as we would like to make it. Look, I made a pretty ignorant statement a few weeks ago. We were talking about the Facebook story where they added a bunch of different gender identifying things.
Yeah.
And I made sort of an offhanded comment and I regretted it later because, wait a second, there are people who are actually dealing with this and I'm an idiot for saying something stupid like that. So before you open your mouth, just think about it a little bit.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Well, you know, the big news all day has just simply been the Ukraine. And Secretary of State Kerry over the weekend got himself some uh, little, little newsworthy. Some Facebook shares definitely with the latest head scratcher, because he did the Sunday Talking Head shows. He was on Meet the Depressed with David Gregory, and Kerry told Gregory, "You just don't in the 21st century behave in 19th century fashion by invading another country on completely trumped up pretext." He went on to say, "You just don't invade another country on phony pretext in order to assert your interests." And the only thought that popped into my head were aluminum tubes. That's all I could come up with, aluminum tubes. Thought that all day long. Anyway, here to give us his insight on what's going on in the Ukraine is our good friend Zach Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Luke, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, it's good to talk to you.
I've got both of you confused.
So, hey, it's good company. Good company.
You look at this, and I know, well, the two of you, you and Zach, had spent some time in the Ukraine, and I remember having conversations with both of you about the situations on the ground, and I had even asked Zach, you know, is what we're seeing in the Ukraine, is this going to turn into an east-west push-pull kind of thing over the Ukraine as we saw during the Cold War? And Zach assured me that it wasn't. It appears that it is.
Well, I'll say on our first day in Kiev, actually almost exactly a month ago, we talked to people on the Maidan Square and just sort of asked for their predictions about how things were going to end out. And actually one of the first things we heard, you know, from a number of people was speculation. You know, is the only question we have is Putin going to invade before the Olympics, during the Olympics, or after the Olympics? I guess we have our answer now, but when we were going through our notes and putting together our stories, that kind of statement given to us almost as casually as it was and as matter-of-factly didn't really fit in. You know, we had these passionate explanations of the intricate political elements of the protests and why they didn't like Yanukovych. But yet when it came down to Russian motives, the arguments were certainly less complex, but they're more matter of fact. And it's funny that so many people called it, and we didn't know how to report on it at the time. But in retrospect, the people there really seemed to, you know, have a sense this was going to happen well before we were able to square it away with our understanding of the country. It's pretty interesting to sit here a month later and see how right those people were.
Yeah, but you know, you look at it and you go, you know, the history of the Soviet Union, you go back to that time, was to do just this, go in and crush things before they got off the ground. And look, you look at Putin and you go, this is a guy who just wants that power and that control again.
Yeah, I mean, you don't even have to go back very far to see even a more modern example of this. I look back to the invasion of Georgia by Russia in 2008. It escaped, you know, most American focus at that time. And then shortly afterwards, the sort of semi-autonomous governments of Abkhazia and South Ossetia put forward text that would, you know, help them really fully secede from Georgia, and it passed. And now you have those areas which say they are broken away and they're occupied by the Russian military. And I think that may be exactly what we're hearing, we're seeing in Crimea right now, where there's a lot of talk about the government there drafting basically the same kind of legislation, legislation that if passed would allow them to fully secede from Ukraine. And I think the real concern at this point is that if it works in Crimea, there's no reason the same thing wouldn't happen in many of the eastern and other southern parts of Ukraine. I mean, the populations there are actually even more supportive traditionally of Yanukovych and of his now banned political party. They're even closer to Russia. There's a higher number of Russian speakers there. And physically, it's closer to Russia also. So you might think it's a little dangerous to acquiesce on allowing Crimea to be, you know, separated out without any sort of referendum from the people, because it will quite quickly, I think, be mimicked in other parts of the country.
Yeah, but even if it is going to pass there, you still got the point of a gun. I mean, what choice do you really have when the Russian military is not just knocking on your door, but sitting in your living room?
Yeah, it's a good point, and I've had some very spirited conversations with you know, even journalists at the UN who make a compelling case, albeit that if this many people, you know, in some of these places, 80, 90% of the population does not want to be part of Ukraine, that they should be free to disassociate. But at the same time, you know, we don't honor contracts that are signed under duress. And there's no better example of that is when you have a very prominent military force breathing down your neck, as is the case in Crimea. So, you know, I think if this is really what people want, there are official and more legitimate seeming ways of you know, moving away from integration with the country, and unfortunately, it's not what we're seeing now. It's all being done in quite a good deal of haste.
Now, so looking back at your time in the Ukraine and looking back at some of the things we've talked about in the past, because, you know, the way this was led to me is, you know, the people who were in the streets, it was primarily a self-determination, more of an economic thing, based on which direction was the country going to go. Were they going to cozy up to Russia? Were they going to move towards the Western model? It seemed more on economic terms. Now it's seeming, well, that was kind of just a pretense.
Well, it's worth noting that, and I wasn't around on your show to talk about it much, and it even escaped my radar for a little while, was that in the wake of Yanukovych being ousted, and again, we're only talking about, you know, 8-9 days ago. This is all very, you know, happening very quickly. The sort of interim government in Kiev was assembled. It didn't feature any of the members of the Party of Regions, which was up until then the largest political party in the country. There were some, you know, legislative actions taken in the parliament that, I think the most prominent one, the one that, you know, ostensibly caused the most frustration, in Crimea was repealing a 2012 law that established two official, languages in Ukraine. And in those regions where minorities speaking languages, accounted for more than 10% of the population. So that effectively in Crimea and in other parts of the south and east, made it so that Russian was an official language, and that was very quickly, you know, undone. And it gave, you know, albeit, you know, I think it's been trumped up, but some, you know, firepower to those Russian-speaking and culturally Russian-Ukrainians who said this government, you know, really just was this new interim government was acting not in the consent of the people. The people didn't necessarily want that law. They should have formed, as they pledged, a coalition government instead of, you know, banning the previous ruling party. And so I think that created an opening, for the arguments that we're hearing from Russia to be made, about, you know, many culturally Russian people in Ukraine being denied their representation in government. And that is probably why we're seeing, the interim government in Kiev start to put the brakes on their legislative agenda a little bit. I think they were very headstrong. You know, after Yanukovych was gone, and maybe a little bit too much so, that they began to infuriate people in the country who obviously weren't happy with Yanukovych going, but, you know, would have preferred, as pledged, to see their representatives stick around a little bit longer and to, you know, wait for another election to see a major shakeup in Kiev.
Yeah, but looking at this, and, you know, I step back and I, you know, you look at, you know, this absolute chaos now, that where does it put the U.S. in all of this? I mean, I know they're talking about some sanctions. I know they're talking about trying to figure out what the Europeans are going to do. I mean, honestly and truthfully, what's the U.S. going to do on this?
It's hard to know. You know, we learned today a little bit, you know, more about the fact that the president may be weighing, an executive order, on sort of a sanctions package. If we look at the economic metrics, Russia is already hurting. I thought it was fascinating to see some of the statistics today. The Russian Central Bank, despite pumping, I think it was close to $12 billion to try to prop up the Russian ruble, it was not able to prevent it from dropping 2% against the dollar. It hit an all-time low. I mean, those are the kind of steps that can really lead to a recession, and there are already fears of that in Russia. And then the stock exchange, the Moscow Currency Exchange, dropping more than $60 billion since Friday. I think that's over 10% of its value. So, you know, the economy is watched very closely by Putin. I think he's certainly encouraged by the fact that so much of Europe is still dependent on his natural gas, including Ukraine. But at the same time, even without sanctions, we're already starting to see some of the negative effects of this kind of foreign policy. Though, again, it doesn't look like that's going to prompt him to de-escalate in the immediate future.
So you brought up the natural gas, which, you know, you're talking about huge amounts of wealth. How much of that is playing into what's going on in the Ukraine? Because I understand that they've got a pretty sizable reserve as well.
You know, they actually were hit with a bill today by Moscow, which sent a copy, actually, of this $3.3 billion unpaid natural gas bill, not just to the new government in Kiev, but to Brussels, to the European Union headquarters, kind of a symbolic you know, bringing everyone back down to earth about the fact that, you know, continued unrest in Ukraine is going to be, you know, an economic problem for everyone to try to figure out. But, no, Ukraine cannot continue, to be embroiled in crisis for too much longer and to lose, you know, this talking about the way this pipeline snakes across the country, the Crimea and the parts of Ukraine that Russia may stand to gain if it keeps pursuing this, sort of annexation strategy, it looks like. Are the parts of the country that carry the pipeline halfway across Ukraine. Conceivably, if Russia were to take the Crimea, they could guarantee the natural gas reached their part of Ukraine and then cut it off going west from there. So it's a very strategic geography that they stand to gain here. You know, just the European level consequences of this country falling out of the EU or European orbits are very drastic, particularly on the issue of energy. And all over this region in Eastern Europe, countries still rely way too heavily on natural gas. Their risk is disproportionately, you know, geared towards Russia. They don't have anything else to turn to as far as energy alternatives.
So would you say someone would be conspiratorial in their thinking if you maybe asked the question, could Putin have been behind some of this? Could this have been something that Moscow kind of whipped up with an end game in mind?
Oh, you know, certainly that's not out of the question. I've heard a number of things from various folks I've talked to and remain in contact with in Kiev, who said the same day that Yanukovych was ousted, the government in Crimea decided that they were going to pursue an annexation strategy at all costs, and they basically rang up Russia and asked how best they could execute that. You know, but, you know, even taking some of those conspiracies away, I think we have a lot of indications that Russia has already won this, if you will. You know, you not only have to look to the removal of Yanukovych by extra-constitutional means. I mean, he was not removed from office in the way that the constitution of the country prescribed, even though the parliament did vote to kick him out of office. That weakened the legal grounds for appealing to the constitution when it comes to Russia having troops on its territory. I listened to UN Ambassador Samantha Power's remarks today saying it is illegal, according to the Ukrainian constitution, for, you know, foreign soldiers to be on Ukrainian territory without the approval of the Constitution. And a number of commentators who are actually sympathetic to the protest movement said, you know, that sounds really nice, but you have to realize that Constitution doesn't exist in real terms anymore. So that's one area of this legal justification for what Putin is doing, where I think he sees some comfort. You look at the military. The Ukrainian military has seen some massive defections over the past 48 hours. You had the head of the Ukrainian Navy defect over the weekend and then accused of treason by the government in Kiev. Then the flagship Ukrainian naval vessel over the weekend asked if it could join the Russian fleet and then thereafter stopped taking commands from Kiev. And finally, I'm just listing so many things that are coming to mind, but in the opposition front, you've got Yatsenyuk, who is the prime minister there. Washington really likes him. You've got Vladimir Klitschko, who the Germans quite like as their sort of choice to lead. They split the opposition. And then you've got Yulia Tymoshenko, the now freed former president, very corrupt herself, who was actually went to go and talk to Vladimir Putin in Russia on behalf of Ukraine. So you've got three prominent moderate leaders of the opposition who are going in three separate directions at this point. And all of this helps Russia to, you know, to be very confident in the fact that the Ukrainian opposition doesn't have much to lean on when it comes to pushing back against their aggression.
Yeah, I mean, I saw the stories that you were mentioning there of the military, you know, saying, I mean, to be honest, when you've got this massive military up against a much smaller military, completely outgunned, again, when you've got a gun to your head, which choices do you make? I guess the question then becomes.
Yeah, and look, Zach and I were in the Crimea very briefly, albeit, And we spoke to young guys on the street who were Ukrainian naval officers, and they said, you know, we really like the Russians. They may get paid a good deal more than we do, and they have better equipment, but we've trained with them since we've been in the armed forces, and they're nice guys, and it's really fun to, you know, play around with their weapons, and we have a great time with them, and we see no reason why we shouldn't be cooperating with them. So when it comes to expecting some sort of military pushback or any sort of diplomatic pushback from the armed forces of Ukraine against Russia, it's just not going to happen. Many of these Ukrainian armed force servicemen see their Russian counterparts as their friends. And that's why we're seeing in the Crimea actually them joining the Russians instead of fighting for Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things both of you guys brought up, that there was a Russian military base right there. And I said, well, you know, there's the beginning, there's the launching point, and here we are.
Yep, that's exactly what's happened.
Last question I've got for you. You know, the folks that in Kiev, who are in the square, what's happening with them right now? I mean, are they still holed up? What's the atmosphere there now?
Well, it's not as tense. Many of the armed individuals there have gone away. Kiev has been described to me as sort of a ghost town when it comes to security or police. Like, there's no one patrolling the streets. Quite the opposite of a few weeks ago, but it's been impressive. Some of the photos I've seen, there have been a lot of volunteer crews, including people I know, going out and cleaning many of the areas that I photographed as being just completely blackened by those tire fires. So, you know, parts of Kiev are starting to look a little bit more normal, but as far as the efficient functioning of the state institutions there, you know, it's quite an opposite. They are as, you know, tarred as they've ever been, and I think their decisions here, they're basically, you know, counting on the West to negotiate on their behalf. You know, you have Kerry landing there shortly, EU mediators there, the UN negotiators, many people from NATO and the EU arriving. I think the government there is sort of a shell of where it would need to be to effectively repel the Russians. So they're going to be leaning quite heavily in the coming days on international actors to do their, negotiating for them, I think.
Well, it will be interesting to see what happens in the next couple of days. Luke, I look forward to getting you back here and telling us a little bit more and keeping us informed. I appreciate it.
Sure thing. Have a great night.
Thanks so much. Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
For and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
There isn't anyone immune from globalization. In fact, the confluence of greed and geography blends seamlessly over all of humanity. As the American workforce has become more sophisticated and smart, corporations have become less agreeable. Of course, there were numerous road signs that led to globalization, and at this point, somewhat improbable that any single cause could be raised from the economic wreckage it has created. However, 1976 may have been a high watermark for the American economy, where a change in the tax code emboldened corporations to move more operations overseas. Where these gutless entrepreneurs once shuttered factories in the Northeast and moved them to southern localities, they were now served up by the U.S. Congress, a world plate, where even to their insatiable greed, the possibilities seemed limitless. The assault on American workers continued in the 1980s when the Reagan administration further retooled the tax code to allow foreign investors to set up American subsidiaries, thereby artfully managing the exodus of U.S.-based corporations. The unseemly alliance between Congress and corporations offers little solace to workers, but does shine a perpetual light on the misgivings of unregulated money flowing into the pockets of greedy politicians. Unions, while greatly weakened over the last two decades, continue to mount credible defenses, proposing balance, equity, and fairness for workers over the broader brush of Congress that would have us believe that globalization can regulate itself. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Minute is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Money.
Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Good news here in Pennsylvania. Soon we will be joining the ranks of a number of other states. I guess there are only like 15 states in the country that don't allow loan sharking. Because Pennsylvania is just one of 15 that say these predatory payday loans, not something we want within the borders of our state. Soon that could come to an end, thanks to Pennsylvania State Representative Chris Ross and Pennsylvania State Senator Pat Brown, both Republicans. They want to make sure that, you know, that 24% rate cap that we have on interest right now no longer exists. Now, they are pushing through a model piece of legislation. Last year, you may remember, Chris Ross, the Republican, pushed through this model legislation. Got through the House, didn't make it through the Senate, though, but now it's back. And the idea is, you know, according to them, they have this idea that somehow that they're going to take, and I'm trying to figure this one out, that the internet, in their view, is somehow filling the void where these payday, where if you had a payday loan place or one of the cash now places, if you had it online, if you had it in the neighborhood, that would be much better regulated than doing it online. And, you know, when you look at it at its face, I got to be honest with you, the people who are being exploited by the neighborhood payday schemers, or what we used to call when I was a kid loan sharks, these are folks who probably don't have internet access at the house. These are people who are not generally internet, they don't have the computer, they don't have the internet. Maybe you could do it at the post office, or maybe you could do it at the library, I don't know, but this argument that we've got to remove this 24% cap and open it up to the 300 to 400% loan sharking that's coming is a good policy. Kind of makes me wonder. And I honestly did not know that we had a cap of 24% on interest rates. This is something that came out of the Pittsburgh Tribune review article. And I'm still checking on it because that seems difficult for me to believe, because I know people who have credit cards, for instance, that are paying 29.9%, which is above the 24% that this article is saying that there's a cap of. According to the article, Senator Brown's bill would remove that cap so that it could be the wild, wild west of interest rates. So if you like what's going on with the energy deregulation, if you like with the wild swings in the cost of electricity, you will absolutely love, what they do with interest rates. So mortgages, credit cards, electricity, whatever, wild, wild swings. And you got to ask the question, why? Why is this so important? I would have to, all I can come up with is more cash into the campaign coffers. Seems that simple to me. Anyway, thanks for being here tonight. Appreciate you tuning in. We will be back tomorrow. I look forward to talking to you. So much to get to tomorrow. So many things we need to be talking about, things we need to stay on top of. I appreciate you taking time for us. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, Stitcher on your smartphone, all of that. Email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's coming like the tide flood beneath the sun.